Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for joining today's web conference, Market Surveillance Committee. If you wish to ask a verbal question, please press #2 on your telephone keypad and you will receive a notification when your line is unmuted. Then please state your name and question. If you require technical assistance, please use the Notes tab on the bottom right-hand side of your screen and address your note to ACTCES operator, or you can call our help desk at 888-796-6118. And with that, I'll turn the call over to Benjamin Hobbs, Chairperson of the Market Surveillance Committee. Benjamin, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, to a meeting of the California ISO Market Surveillance Committee. And we have three major items on the agenda concerning the CCDEB, Commitment Costs and Default Bid Enhancements Initiative. That will take up all the morning, definitely. And then this afternoon, we'll be looking at contingency modeling enhancements and generator contingency and remedial action scheme modeling. Those two initiatives this afternoon are scheduled to go to the board in September, and we will be writing opinions on those. The CCDEB is, I guess, tentatively scheduled for November. But before we get into the substantive items, first find out if there's any public comments on any issue. First, we'll ask folks in the room and then folks online whether you have any comments or questions on any issue. If it's related to one of the later agenda issues, I'd prefer that you wait. But if for some reason you can't participate in a later discussion, you can ask it or say it now. First of all, any public comment within the room? No hands here. Operator, can you ask if anybody on the phone lines has a public comment at this time?
Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a verbal question, please press #2 on your telephone keypad, and you will receive a notification when your line is unmuted. Then please state your name and your question. Once again, press #2 to indicate you have a comment or question.
Okay. Operator, so there's nobody. Is that correct?
There's no one on the line with the question.
Okay. Thank you for checking. All right. We'll move on to the next agenda item, which is a decision on the general session minutes. Dr. Harvey wanted to make one correction, which is that his attendance was by phone line thanks to disruption in the airline system. He participated by phone from Boston, so the minutes need to be changed to reflect that. And let's see, any other discussion? Jim?
Nope. Subject to that change, I propose we adopt the minutes.
Okay, it's been moved and just seconded by Jim Bushnell and then Scott Harvey. Any further discussion? If not, Jim?
I vote yes.
Yes.
Scott votes yes, and I vote yes. The minutes from the May 5th, 2017 in-person meeting have been adopted. Okay, we can now go to Kathleen Colward, who's going to be telling us, summarizing where we're at now in terms of the CCDEB initiative. A lot of progress has been made. I think this is the third meeting in a row, or the fourth meeting where we've had this on the agenda. We've seen a lot of the evolution, a lot of hard work.
I think that sounds about right.
There's still more hard work to come. And so you're basically, this discussion will be part of that. Okay, Kathleen.
Thank you, Ben. As Ben mentioned, what our plan is to do today is to provide a 30-minute level-setting presentation that will give a broad overview of the issues, the background, and the California ISO's proposals to address the concerns that have been raised by stakeholders under this initiative, Commitment Costs and Default Energy Bid Enhancements. As Ben mentioned, we brought this to the MSC several times over the last few meetings, and today we're looking to provide that overview and introduction to the CISO's proposal, and then have a robust discussion and receive feedback from the MSC on important design items to contemplate as we move forward.
Kathleen, if I can interrupt just for a second, I should warn folks that we'll be having two other presentations after Kathleen's. one by myself summarizing past opinions in this area and the principles that we've enunciated. And then Dr. Harvey will be making also a presentation focusing on mitigation. So that means we have a packed hour and a half. Mm-hmm. I definitely want robust discussion, so we may wind up breaking for lunch a little bit later than what is shown tentatively on the schedule of 11:45. But let's see how it goes. Okay, thanks.
Sounds great. Thank you. The objective of this initiative is to pursue comprehensive solutions to the ongoing commitment cost and default energy bid enhancement issues that have been raised by stakeholders. Suppliers need more flexibility to reflect unique costs and volatility. By increasing that flexibility, we can better support integration of renewable resources through incentivizing flexible resources participation, especially during tight fuel supply, account for cost of flexible resources, gas and non-gas resources, to reduce the risk of insufficient cost recovery, and then to encourage participation of the non-resource adequacy and voluntary energy imbalance market resources. It's important to note that this is also the stakeholder initiative that will be used as the vehicle to ensure compliance with FERC Order 831's final rule that was released in November of 2016. This rule requires the ISO to support verified cost-based offers of energy component above $1,000 per megawatt hour. The ISO has implemented several incremental changes to the bidding rules over the past decade. Stakeholders maintain that while these incremental changes have been improvements, that they have remained insufficient to resolve the concerns that have been raised over the past decade. The California ISO is committed to pursuing comprehensive changes to resolve these bidding rule concerns. And again, I want to emphasize that there are portions of this proposal that are required, and they are required in order for the CAISO to comply with FERC Order 831, which increases and bid caps on cost-based components up to $2,000 per megawatt hour. But essentially what that order is doing is creating a new policy directive that we need to be able to support cost-based offers regardless of the value. If they can be verified prior to the market run, then they should be able to contribute to setting the dispatch and pricing signals that are released from our market solution. If it cannot be verified prior to the market, then we must still pursue an after-the-fact verification process that if these cost-based offers can be verified through a more diligent, thorough review, they would be eligible for uplift payments, uplift resettlement. Background. I mentioned that we have pursued, over the last 10 years, we've done between 11 to 12 different stakeholder initiatives, all addressing pieces of the scope items that has now been aggregated into this initiative, CCDEBI, that touched on bidding flexibility, market-based offers for commitment costs, after-the-fact recovery process, improving the delivered price estimate on our gas price index to include transport costs, lots of different small incremental changes that have moved the ball forward, but we stakeholders have continued to raise at board meetings that there remains a gap, and that's what we're here in this initiative to try to bridge. Our current design, what is that gap? The current design restricts suppliers from being able to accurately reflect cost expectations. We want to emphasize and make it very clear that California is the only organized market, FERC jurisdictional organized market, that does not support market-based commitment cost bids that are subject to mitigation. We're also the only organized market with a reference level design that does not support suppliers to request adjustments to either the fuel price or the reference level prior to the market run in order to better reflect volatility. The current bidding rules restrict suppliers from reflecting these estimated costs and business needs, which has been the concern underlying this has exacerbated with the continued expansion of our energy imbalance market, as well as the increasingly diverse supply resources. Why are we concerned about overly limiting bid prices? Well, here are two reasons. We're concerned because it can undermine market efficiency, as well as it can discourage participation. And discouraging participation is extremely important. So we'll talk about participation a lot as we go through these stakeholder conversations. It takes a fleet that is comprised of both resource of RA resources, non-RA, and EIM resources in order to create the most robust, efficient, and reliable operations of the system. And we want to encourage the participation of the full market in order to continue to participate on a regular basis. What are our supply offers broken into up to four components? We generally will refer to it as a three-part bid, although transition costs are a biddable component. This includes energy, minimum load, transition, and startup. We'll refer to the minimum load, transition, and startups as commitment cost components, and the energy as the energy component. So our energy bids are hourly bids, and under uncompetitive conditions, we will replace those with the default energy bids. Our default energy bid will be the higher of either the competitive LMP or the DEB option that has been selected, which could be negotiated, variable, which would be an estimate, a production cost, or the LMP option. For our commitment cost bids, these are daily cost-based bids. Because they are cost-based bids, they are validated. They are de facto mitigated and subject to a validation metric of 125% of the CAISO's administratively calculated cost estimate, which we will refer to as our proxy cost. And this is applied across the board every hour. There's been some robust discussion, and I think also during one of the MSCs, the Department of Market Monitoring presented a proposal under this initiative. Under that proposal, the market monitor proposed to make permanent the Aliso Canyon temporary measure, allowing the ISO to manually use an approximation of the next day index for its day ahead market processes. The second proposal was to apply a Monday premium that would be based on a statistical difference between same day, intraday, or the Monday only package that relative to the next day index. Third would be to create and publish a real-time gas price index. And then finally, to provide more guidelines for the after-the-fact filing right at FERC, which is, on the energy side, a temporary provision under the Aliso Canyon measures, and for the commitment cost bids has been made a permanent tariff provision. We want to clarify that the ISO is not pursuing this recommendation due to the three following reasons. There were strong regulatory concerns with using price information from non-index or non-benchmark trades that are not subject to a robust oversight mechanism that would be able to capture cross-market impacts. The second reason is that there is too excessive of an implementation effort and investment needed to become a gas index publisher in addition to the core business of the ISO. And then finally, a lot of the stakeholder support to potentially pursue this as an interim measure or a bridged solution was based on the assumption that this might be able to be implemented sooner than fall of 2018. At least this was the ISO's understanding from our conversations with stakeholders and review of their comments. We do want to clarify that fall of 2018 is the earliest time that any proposed implementation could be effective in the market, and that if we were to postpone any of the longer-term comprehensive solutions that we've been discussing in this initiative, it could potentially push it back to 2020 or beyond. Yes, Scott?
The non-index trades, does that mean that you would not be continuing to use the average of the early morning trades as the basis for mitigation in the dam?
That's a great question. So using the approximation of the early morning timely trades that we are using under our day-ahead market processes, that was something that was quite contentious and what has led to some of this information about real time. We were able to reach an agreement with the commission that we could continue to use that at least on a temporary basis. We did have to go through extensive conversations confirming and attesting to the best of our ability that those trades were compliant with FERC's policy for natural gas and electricity price index publishers, which is kind of the second bullet talks about that. Because the Intercontinental Exchange, there's several different requirements in that policy. The way that the data is stored, the fact that it is counterparty level data, the counterparty, the volume, the amount, as well as they screen for anomalies and outliers in the production of those indices, because that is something that is complied with on the actual published next day index, we are pulling an earlier estimated print of that between 8:30 and 9, but it is still pulling an approximation of an index that is compliant. So because of that, the dam is fine, but the real-time market, what we call quote-unquote real-time, are either same-day, intraday, or Monday-only trades that are not indexed. Because they're not indexed, they wouldn't be screened for anomalies or outliers or fit all of the requirements underlying that index publisher. So they fall into a different situation.
Okay, now the first bullet up there, does that mean you are or not going to continue to do that? Because isn't the first bullet what we're talking about?
The first bullet, so there's DAM in real time. The first bullet's talking about the real time issue, not the day ahead issue. Because that day ahead approximation is from they are price setting trades, as opposed to the real time or non-price setting
right,
trades.
That proposal is an approximation of the next day index, right? So
yeah. So you mean the first bullet under the proposal and not?
Under the market monitor proposal. The first bullet, I'm trying to understand whether you're saying that's
no
longer going to be done?
No, sorry, it's a good question. We are not proposing right now. Okay, hold on one second. So the way that I understand your question is you are asking if the ISO is continuing to contemplate making permanent the use of that approximation. Under this proposal, that was not a part of what was proposed. It has a high manual burden, and it is something that would be very difficult for us to continue to do in the long term. It also is subject to a great deal of margin of error because it is reliant on humans to come in and be available at a given time and to manually relay that to our calculator that's able to produce those estimates. For all of those reasons, it's not a robust long-term direction. That wasn't listed in one of the reasons on why we're not pursuing those. What we are putting forward is a proposal that includes expanding our cost framework to allow for negotiated proxy costs as well as allowing for the adjustments. Those adjustments would be done on an exception basis, and they're addressing the conditions that really warrant the need for greater flexibility. And that's something that we can automate, and especially with the verification requirements that came out of 831, that provides us the route forward where that's already a sunk cost that we need to develop the verification framework by which we would verify any of those cost-based adjustments. So from a implementation perspective and a cost to the company, it makes more sense to pursue this direction, which is also the same flexibility provided by every other market, than to continue to do something that is heavily manual and subject to a great deal of error. And that's the reason for the first one, why at least at this time we are not proposing to make it permanent.
So with these changes, we'll end up going back to using day-ahead indexes, indexes that are a day off?
We kind of call that sometimes the lagged next-day index. I call it the first gas days index, the one that represents flows from 7 a.m. beginning on our day-ahead up until 7 a.m. during the operating day. Yes, with this proposal from a standard generic default energy bid or proxy cost perspective, it would go back to the day-ahead market process to be based off of that lagged index. But what's important is that if that lagged, even we've heard this from many stakeholders, is that on average, even that lagged index is a decent representation unless fundamentals have changed drastically between the two gas days, the two timely trading and nomination cycles. If that were to happen, there would be sufficient time to come in and request an adjustment or this deviation from that generic default energy bid and proxy cost. And that's exactly what we were trying to find back of the envelope approaches that we could implement on a temporary basis while we were continuing to stakeholder and determine what would be more efficient. We believe it would be more efficient to treat to actually address the conditions that are exceptional from a deviation perspective, to deviate away from the generic estimate rather than to introduce a process that could could introduce errors with the ability of the market to run, and it would be it's a very high risk that if that were not to if the value of that day ahead of this approximation were not to get put into place prior to the day ahead market, didn't translate appropriately through the user interface, wasn't recalculated, that could actually that could prevent the market from running in the day ahead. And so that is a high risk. And so from a reliance on a manual perspective, and I would note that we have had a lot of struggles trying to automate it and have not been able to get any approval licensing perspective. So on the first bullet, the ISO has done as much as it can to pursue the concept of making that permanent. And we have not, from a legal perspective, nor from a manual and risk perspective of potentially stopping the timing out the day-ahead market, we do not believe that that is the most efficient approach. We do think that the proposal that we're bringing forward, or we brought forward in our straw proposal, which is to allow for ex-ante adjustments to those estimates that could be requested prior to the day-ahead market, would be based off of the guidelines that we're defining so that you can reflect that higher estimate in the day-ahead market, will bridge the gap that has continued to be that we've been trying to address, and it does it in an exceptional basis so that there isn't an inflation of the market, an artificial inflation of the market prices, because we're trying to increase headroom or introduce a scaler that pushes that up just because there's some concerns that there are these anomaly events where you need to reflect higher value.
Maybe we can get back to this when we get to you're describing the proposal.
Sure. But
so are Mondays treated any differently? Or maybe we should defer that kind of questioning until we get to describing.
Yeah, here, let me, proposal. I'm actually just gonna, let me breathe through very quickly, and then I think we'll get to there in like two slides. The important parts of the in summary, what we're proposing is to allow market-based offer for the three-part bid subject to mitigation. So introducing a mitigation test where we would apply that to our commitment cost components so that those could be market-based offers. We think that bridges a great deal of the risk that we have been discussing. Even when we talk about which of our suppliers or which of our components are really exposed to the market design being overly limited, we always focus on commitment costs. And the reason we're always focusing on commitment costs is because we don't experience frequent mitigation of resources on our energy components. So we have a frequently mitigated unit adder, and I can tell you, at least let's use that as a dirty proxy for are we overly mitigating. And if we can use that as a proxy, we don't include that FMU adder on any of the default energy bids. So we believe that we have a very robust mitigation design that is applied to our energy costs. And because they can reflect that they have the flexibility for the market-based offers, they're able to capture and accurately reflect their willingness to sell in a way that, at least for our energy bids, the CAISO does not feel that there is a high risk, which is what we maintained in our comments under 831. Commitment cost bids, they don't have the market-based offer. They have the cost-based offer, and it's subject to our administratively calculated estimates, which includes a lot of assumptions. And they're fairly generic formulas, although they are specific to the heat rates that are on file and a geographically approximate fuel region, which is based on a delivered fuel price estimate. The focus of the initiatives over the last decade have been, how do we improve that cost estimate? I think what you're hearing from the CAISO and from our work with our stakeholders is, what we have landed on is that that's not the priority. The priority is, how do we create a better market design where we can support market-based offers, balance against our need to protect against market power concerns. If we focus on that route, then the market-based offers would occur under competitive conditions, and there is very little risk of having an overly restrictive design. Once an uncompetitive condition is identified, then we completely agree that we need to focus on how do we ensure that even under uncompetitive conditions, that suppliers' mitigated values are reasonable reflections of their cost expectations. But I think our first priority is, how do we introduce the market-based offers on that commitment cost side? That will greatly reduce the risk to suppliers that they are not able to reflect their value. once you, another part, part and parcel of that is, we've heard that having the, a lot of suppliers need the flexibility to reflect minimum load costs vary by hour across the day. We are proposing to treat the minimum load component as an hourly value, changing the big component to an hourly type. Our minimum load costs include two, you could think of them as including two different cost portions. The run hour cost associated with being synchronized to the grid and running for that hour, as well as the fuel cost associated with operating up to your minimum load, the actual fuel proxy cost for that minimum load energy. Because it is a fuel proxy cost, we agree and we find it reasonable that those costs may vary, especially under conditions where generators may need to re-rate their minimum load to higher levels, and so there truly is a greater fuel cost portion associated with that. The second is that as far as, now let's assume that we, the final proposal, which we've already talked about, and we have proposed to enhance our mitigation design to allow for these market-based offers. Let's focus on, I think, what the questions are that the MSC is bringing is, once we've identified uncompetitive conditions, how do we ensure that those are reasonable reflections? In our workshops, we've landed on there's two driving issues. One, there are some suppliers that have more unique costs, maybe a different cost component than our generic formula has. Maybe they look at the risk because of the way that their PUC or their PUC equivalent requires them to operate or approves the operation of those units. Maybe they value their risk differently, and it could be warranted. The California ISO tariff already contemplates the idea that there may need to be consultations or negotiations that allow for the discussion between a scheduling coordinator, the California ISO, and the Department of Market Monitoring to have the discussion about whether or not those are warranted. If you successfully negotiate this unique cost formulation, they are then filed at FERC. There are the specifics of what every negotiated rate is for the side is non-transparent. We believe from having conversations with our stakeholders that one of the main asks is, you provide us this flexibility on the energy component. Why can't you provide us that same flexibility for the min load, the transition, and the startup if we could warrant that our fuel costs needed to be have a different approach for our energy? That's the should be the same basis for the startup and the minimum load that also include a fuel cost portion. So what has come to light is that you have the same fuel proxy cost in multiple different components, and there's an incongruity when we treat them differently. That is why we are proposing to leverage and extend the negotiated rate framework to the entire supply offer so that every component could be negotiated and establish a more tailored or more unique approach. Now, the final bullet here, we're trying to emphasize this really only bridges the gap that the negotiated default energy bid even addresses today. It addresses the need for reflecting more systematic costs that differ by definition, even under stable conditions. This does not address the volatility concerns. We've focused a lot on volatility in the last several years at these MSC meetings, so we did want to bring out that there is a different class of concern, but it's one that we don't talk about because from an energy perspective, we believe that we have a robust approach that bridges that gap, and that's the one that contributes the largest amount to the dispatch and the pricing solution. So I feel like this hasn't been brought to light as much, but this to us, this adding and extending the negotiation, is a huge advancement that would really bridge at least half of the issues that have been raised. The other one, which is, assume now that we have bridged that gap. We have negotiated and estimated approaches for all of the components.
Actually, Kathleen's going to just, on the negotiated option, did those normally take the form of a number or a formula that's linked to some unit-specific kind of variable?
So I am not an expert on the negotiated, and I will certainly open it up to anyone in the room. I will tee the answer up that it, my understanding is that it is largely, the ISO has the flexibility to negotiate off of a value or a formula, but there is, we do largely negotiate off of formulas. And so it essentially takes the same concept of the default energy bid, but allows for additional components or a slightly different approach to be taken, even to estimate a delivered fuel price, if the way that the fuel regions are overly restrictive. I also know that it is a quite a rigorous process, and a lot of support needs to be provided that these unique formulations are warranted. Would DMM like to add anything? They're the ones who host the negotiated process.
Hi, this is Mike Castellano from DMM. I'm also not particularly knowledgeable in this area. I think a lot of these end up being formulas, but that would be something that you would, Jim, if you want to know a more detailed answer, we can talk a little bit later, and I can ask the people who actually work on that.
And my sense is, I was going to ask sort of for statistics on what percentage of current units use this for, but I guess my sense is that the EIM is a whole different kind of situation, so I'm not sure how informative the current internal sort of frequency of negotiated is going to be, how relevant that would be when we extend it to both commitment costs and outside the footprint. But.
So responding to that kind of as high level as possible, because these are very confidential processes, the process itself can translate to anywhere in the footprint. There's nothing unique about the energy imbalance market areas that they would not fit into our negotiation process. Any other questions? Okay, I'd like to move on to the proposed scope item that would address the need to reflect changes in really to reflect changes in what a supplier's expectation of their costs are as a result of fundamentals changing significantly after one of the indices that we use as the basis for the generic kind of estimates are used. What we are proposing is to allow for ex ante adjustments, so a supplier to come in prior to the market run and request an adjustment in, if it's for the energy portion, in a dollar per megawatt hour amount, for the transition cost, dollars per transition, starts, dollars per start, and minimum load, dollar per hour. So to request an adjustment from those estimated values to one that is better reflective of their cost expectations. This is the vehicle, I want to also emphasize that this proposal is what will allow for us to be in compliance with FERC Order 831. FERC Order 831 requires the ISO support cost-based energy bids above $1,000 per megawatt hour. Our method for introducing cost-based energy bids is our default energy bid if it were to be determined that there were uncompetitive conditions. Under 831, we are only required to support cost-based offers above $1,000 per megawatt. So from that perspective, we're proposing that if I'll use examples from that order of magnitude, if a supplier expected that their energy costs would be around $1,500 per megawatt hour, they would be able to come in prior to the market run and request for this ex ante adjustment of their cost-based energy bid up to $1,500 to be adjusted up to $1,500 per megawatt hour. These would be subject to verification requirements, and we are proposing to evaluate this adjustment against a reasonableness threshold. These reasonableness thresholds would be slightly different than the default energy bid or the proxy cost. Their representation of what the CAISO would expect based on some statistical analysis, what could reasonably fall into a range that could represent cost expectations. When we talk, and the reason I emphasize this is different than a default energy bid or proxy cost, those estimates contribute to the commitment dispatch solution and the energy price signal. So from that perspective, we need to be more conservative, especially when we are talking about replacing market-based bids to cost-based bids that contribute to dispatch and pricing solution. the reason that we can provide thresholds that may be slightly less conservative for the purpose of the adjustment is that that is something that the suppliers would request, because they are coming in and requesting and representing that as their cost expectation. It's now not inflating or introducing a scalar across the board to a class of resources regardless of their cost. It is allowing for a resource who is in a unique situation that is exposed to a great deal of risk because of changes in price volatility to request that deviation, and that we are proposing to create guidelines and kind of explain the conditions that may warrant this. The simple condition is that after the next day index is published, you have a risk of being dispatched and receiving a real-time incremental instruction when the real-time or quote-unquote real-time same-day, intraday transactions are trading at a significant premium. And when I say significant, I mean 10%. And the reason that I'm saying that is that that is the 110% is the scalar that is included in the default energy bid. And under our proposal with market-based commitment cost components, we're proposing to align those scalars even in the mitigated proxy cost so that it would be 110% scalar in the mitigated proxy cost. So 110% would become the threshold by which you can cover your incidental cost in our standard process. If volatility occurs that would move you outside of that 110%, that becomes a reasonable condition for requesting a deviation above that so that the ISO can continue to have an efficient dispatch as well as ensure that there is sufficient cost recovery.
Could I, is this limited to when prices are over $1,000, or does it also cover the case in which, you know, the day the price was $5 yesterday, but the gas price today is $25, so I need to bid $25, not $5?
It does. And that's kind of, I'm spilling a little bit of more time on the concept of what is a significant difference, and where the CAISO has gone is that if it's significant if that 110% relative to the benchmark used in that estimate cannot capture your cost expectation.
So this applies all the time, not just for $1,000. Okay, mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say it may allow a supplier to reflect gas system limitations, is that is one of the areas in which ex ante negotiations might occur over it, or is it pro forma just going to be something considered?
So this doesn't include ex ante negotiations or consultations. We, given our time frame and how frequently we run our real-time market, and we have the T-75 close, we do not, and frankly, all of the resources that go into supporting that operations, we don't have the bandwidth to support negotiations ex ante. For that reason, we're proposing an automated ex ante screen that these would be validated against. So the reasonableness thresholds would be calculated prior and held in our systems, and if an adjustment request were received, we would screen that against that reasonableness threshold. I'm actually going to skip right here. So what we're talking about
but
is
just to clarify. Yeah. So if nothing strange is happening, gas system limitations would not be included.
Correct.
But there's something that would be a great example of what would be part of an ex ante request. But you're automating it. Okay.
Perfect. Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
So the may allow statement then says that the thresholds.
Correct.
The thresholds will be defined with those sorts of instances in mind, and you'll have criteria as to whether those circumstances have occurred or not, and so there'll be some sort of decision tree or something. We're in this situation today, so here are the thresholds.
Okay. Yes. So here, it's actually, for me, really helpful to look at the flow chart. So this is the best way to kind of understand what we are proposing. Under competitive conditions, we are proposing that the supply offer have market-based components for every single component. And if a mitigation test does not identify uncompetitive conditions, the market-based supply offer would be used in the market. The second tier is a mitigation test does identify concerns that market power could be influenced. And so we call this uncompetitive conditions without a reference level adjustment. So this is an uncompetitive condition, but there is not necessarily, no supplier has identified that there were significant volatility that they would need to reflect that in their offers, and either the negotiated or the estimated approach that we are proposing to support across the entire offer would capture stable conditions. So the idea of this is more stable, kind of predictable, the benchmarked indices are capturing those expectations appropriately. In that instance, we would mitigate them to, if uncompetitive conditions were identified, the cost-based offer then, the way that CAISO approaches that is we replace the market-based offer with a cost-based offer. The mitigated price on the energy side, like I said, higher of the competitive LMP or the DEB. And then we are proposing to replace, if a commitment cost component was, if conditions were identified that would need to be mitigated, to a mitigated proxy cost. We are proposing that mitigated proxy cost is the same proxy cost formulation with the addition of the ability to negotiate a more tailored approach. And those would include 110% scalar, similar to how the default energy bid includes 110% scalar. That would be used in the market if there was no reference level adjustment requested. The third tier is conditions arise, and we'll lean in on, Jim, the scenario of the gas system limitations. Gas system limitations have, we are serving constrained conditions on the gas side. Let's say that we are at hour ending 12, we're in the real-time market, and they have, there's fuel availability limitations upstream. In that instance, the supplier could come in and request an adjustment from that proxy cost or the default energy bid up to a cost-based offer for any of those components that is more representative of their expectations of costs. So once that occurs, what that triggers is we move over to the right and we follow that arrow and we perform an ex-ante review. The ex-ante review there is what I was referring to where we would screen that against reasonableness thresholds. And the decision box is, do the bids pass the screen? If so, awesome, great. So, yes, and then we would use that requested level in the market. I think it's important to note that this tier is applying, these are triggered, these are, a supplier has to actually request it, so it doesn't apply across the board. So what would be used in the market would be a combination of the reference levels that do not, did not need an adjustment, and a revised reference level based on an approved adjustment if it was needed. In the instance that it does not pass the screen, we go down from the bids pass screen diamond down to no, and what would we do? Two things. We would first, we would adjust that, we would take that adjustment request, and let's, my example is $1,500 per megawatt hour. So let's say that our reasonableness threshold was pricing at $1,000 per megawatt hour. That's what we would expect even from a statistical backward look at the differences between same day and next day trading over several seasons, if that, that could be one manner of coming up with a threshold. If that was estimated at $1,000 per megawatt hour, we would adjust that down from $1,500 to $1,000 per megawatt hour and use that in the market for contributing to dispatch and setting prices. But the, simultaneously, that original submitted adjustment request of $1,500 per megawatt hour would be sent to an ex post verification process, where in that ex post process, we would review it again, supporting documentation consistent with the conditions that are listed to see if that adjustment request was formed based on the guidelines and under the conditions that have been described as appropriate. If so, we would consider it verified after the fact, and it would be eligible for an uplift recalculation. If the market revenues did not compensate it and result in a revenue surplus, it could receive a revised invoice.
Stephanie, when you pass the bid screen there, now suppose we're dealing with that hypothetical we talked about earlier where yesterday's gas price was $5, today in the early trading it's $25. Would the ex-ante screen be to look at the early trades on ICE and just be basically, instead of using an index, just use it as a screen?
Not necessarily. We, and I want to full disclosure that as far as the policy work has gone, this is about the extent that we have released and the details on this. And so I'm curious to hear kind of your thoughts on this. Our current position is that we have been working with the New York ISO and had some in-depth conversations with those who operate the way that they support the fuel price adjustment. And the way that they support it is that they have created fuel entry thresholds. These thresholds are based on, as we understand them and how it was explained to us, they look at the prior seasons, they look at like days, to look at the difference between same day, intraday transactions relative to that next day index. Both they have a day ahead and a real-time threshold, so it's relative, the day ahead thresholds are relative to the lagged in next day index, and the real-time thresholds are relative to now, I believe to the second gas day, but I can clarify that. But the concept of having a day ahead and a real-time threshold at least would translate to us similar to, in that way, because we have the lagged indices for our day ahead and the next day index published the morning of our day ahead market for a real-time process. They look at that from a historical perspective, a statistical difference. I know that they remove some outliers. It smooths out. What that does is it creates a statistically based threshold by which it seemed reasonable for cost to fall in within that. And having these discussions, and I think we're fairly aligned across the ISO and NGOs that the advantage to this approach is that it puts the onus on the suppliers to request that and to communicate to the ISO that these are their cost expectations. Once that communication is received, they are then subject to the rules by which they cannot submit false or misleading information. So when we're talking about what is protecting against artificial price impact, the requirement that a supplier cannot communicate false or misleading information to the FERC jurisdictional entity, that is providing that protection against the artificial price impact. And the threshold that they create is one that is statistical, like days over the past couple seasons, I believe, where they come up with a percentage difference. That
so
they
we're going to do this, but I mean, that like days is if you're going to control for changes in temperature, you know, weather forecast and so forth, and understand and you know what the degree of constraint on the LDC. But are we going to be able to do that as opposed to if this just becomes we're going to look at all historically all days, what's the variation? You're going to find well, most days the variation is small, and then you'll be saying no, everybody always fails. So I mean, whether this provides any benefit depends a lot on how you do this screening.
We 100% agree, and I'm actually wondering if I have. I'm not sure if any of these slides have our more detailed slides that we went through with stakeholders included a conversation about a feedback loop. So one of the proposed components of this screen is that it includes a feedback loop so that the manual efforts on both the scheduling coordinator side as well as the ISO would be balanced. So let's keep walking down this logic chain. If a supplier is submitting a request for an adjustment and it doesn't pass the screen and it goes through the ex post verification and we're able to verify it after the fact, I'd say if this happens once and we do anticipate, but maybe we'll learn something through that verification process and then we could update that threshold. And just
that doesn't work because that just says that if it's highly variable and we don't look at the actual trades, so gradually you get 150, 175, 200% all the time because sometimes it's that big.
I guess this is not going to pick up unusual events because by definition a statistical screen is going to sort of look for things that really weren't unusual, but just when you look at enough observables, enough sort of other factors, then you understand the picture better. But if it's something out of the ordinary, then by definition, you're not going to be able to pick it up.
What I think that, so maybe spending a little bit of time on what is the goal that we're trying to address. And the goal that we're trying to address several goals. One of them would be improving price formation. Another would be ensuring that there is sufficient cost recovery. From a price formation perspective, we believe that needs to be balanced against protections against market power. And leaning perhaps more heavily on a preference for balancing against market power and having more conservative screening that would protect against that. The Texas position is that we want to create a market design that is robust enough to result in an efficient solution to the best of our ability, consistent with our concerns with market power. Given that, we still want to support what is the policy goals that were described in 831 that we share as well, that there should be sufficient cost recovery. So I think our preference, not preference, but what is most important in this proposal is the ex post verification process. The screen is something that that is how we can validate an adjustment. And to the extent possible, we will allow that to be used in the market for purposes of setting dispatch and price signals. But if it doesn't fall within a reasonableness threshold, then we want to have the flexibility to do a more robust review of that request after the fact to ensure. And this is one thing that I get quoted to me all the time. Once the artificial price impact has been injected into the market and affects the locational marginal price, that's something very difficult to unwind. So the preference is to protect against it first, but to ensure that our market design has a process, this ex post verification process, by which we are not imposing an overly burdensome price risk on suppliers by having this limitation. So the expansion of our design to support this ex post process, I think, is what we see as having the largest value add. Thank you. Technical difficulties. I think for the most part, we've talked through the proposal. We've talked about allowing for hourly variation. We've talked about the negotiated proxy cost. We've talked about ex-ante adjustments and the process behind that, the automated screening, how we would do an uplift resettlement. I just want to reiterate that the adjustments are the vehicle for compliance with 831. The energy component could be adjusted up above $1,000 per megawatt hour, subject to $2,000 per megawatt hour capped. But we would still support the receiving cost-based energy adjustments above $2,000. They would just be subject purely to that ex post process. So again, some of the indications that we are interpreting from that order is that having that a robust ex post process is very important, and so that's where we are definitely focusing a lot of our attention.
Sorry, just the Monday adjustment, is that something that would be part of the screen for the ex ante adjustment then, or would that just be automatically included in the BEB calculation?
There is no proposal for a Monday adjustment.
There would be neither, okay.
Yeah, neither. There is no proposal to change our default energy bid or our proxy cost to include price information from non-index trades.
But the market participant wouldn't he make a request to say, the gas, you're using $5, the actual cost is $25, I want to use $25, you turn him down because your screen isn't right, and then he gets made hold an uplift, right?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily assume the screen wouldn't be right. So,
okay.
And I think we, because of the proposal to have a feedback loop, and because of the proposal to have it be based off of more of a statistical approach and to have set thresholds, we may be more comfortable, and I think this is an important thing, is that we're going to be much more conservative with the estimate of our mitigated price levels. So our debts and our proxy costs are going to be based off of indexed transactions that have some kind of oversight mechanism that can protect against cross-market manipulation. We're also going to be conservative at the scalar level. 110% is the one that we've historically used. Those contribute to dispatch solution and pricing. The CAISO's proposal is to be very conservative when it can directly influence the market solution. From a threshold perspective, we believe that we can provide more flexibility because it is a supplier requesting that on an ad hoc exceptional basis where they are required to not submit false or misleading information to the California ISO. If you were to include information that is not from if we were to include pricing information from those same-day intraday trades that are not subject to a robust oversight mechanism, that opens the electricity markets up almost perfectly to the ability for price-setting transactions in an external market that we have no transparency into who the counterparties are that are trading in that market. We have no control over liquidity. One thing that I think is really important to note is that while we talk about next day markets as being liquid, they are illiquid from a gas trading perspective. The majority of natural gas transactions that are traded are done through bid week trading for prompt month pricing that are released, either referred to normally as IFRC or NGI publishes those first of month indices. Most of the trading is done at that point. These next day markets are used to shape those monthly positions and to continue to hedge against those risks or to roll it from a first of month to an end of month perspective. When you talk about next day trading from a gas perspective, those are illiquid. When you talk about same day intraday markets, those are the I have completely messed up my book perspective. Those are not the products that you would want to be pricing any kind of market price off of. Another reason is that most prudent trading will avoid those products to the extent possible. So when we're talking about changing our generic estimates that we use for every single resource that fills into a bucket, that doesn't produce an efficient market solution. Because while CAISO agrees, there may be some market participants that have a need to go into that market, have a need to go buy those products. It's not going to be every market participant. And because of that, that's one of the main drivers why it is not efficient to include that across the board for mitigated price reasons, but it could be, and we could be more relaxed on our thresholds on these screens because of that ability for us to screen for artificial price impact.
So the intent then is to price discriminate and the generators that are marginal and get paid their costs and inframarginal generators aren't? Is that what you mean by, I mean, if the price goes from $5 to $25, I assume that all generators are going to come in and say, I want the $25. Are you saying that they wouldn't get it if they bought some of that gas forward?
Scott, I think the intention of a lot of these policy efforts is to ensure that suppliers are compensated for their cost expectations.
Okay. So every supplier is going to come in on that. When the price was $5 yesterday and it's $25 today, every supplier is going to come in, regardless of whether they're long and short, because that's the opportunity cost of the gas. And they'll be, and by request, they just put in a bid at that level, or what?
What this proposal is to request an adjustment away from the default energy bid or the proxy cost. And again, I just want to emphasize that the most important part of this proposal is to support market-based offers for the entire supply offer. So that CAISO would assume that the majority, given the fact that we are not frequently mitigating on our default energy bid perspective, that we would observe similar circumstance for the entire supply offer. And so a lot of the concerns and the volatility and the reflecting of value that I think we're talking about is largely mitigated by introducing those market-based offers, by having a framework where we can support a robust market design the majority of the time. We're now talking about a very small set of instances.
Well, it all depends on how the market power screen plays out.
Which is
Can I just ask DMM, we've heard concerns about the robustness and reliability of the intraday market, and yet it's something that was part of your recommendation. So how do you guys feel about the concerns that Kathleen's articulated here?
So I think one of the key things that Kathleen is talking about is this idea that one of the ISO objections to the DMM proposal is that we apparently propose to create and publish a real-time index. I guess if you look at our comments. There's a couple maybe not ideal word choices in there, different to make our intent a little clearer, but I think our intent is more something like Scott's talking about, where if somebody, DMM or ISO or somebody, can look at trades and see when there's a significant price move and be able to make some kind of update in the market prices and the prices that are used to generate DEBs in order to take that information into account. In terms of, the manipulability of the gas markets, I think, I guess that's, there's some possibility there, but it seems to me what we're really talking about is, either from what I understand of the ISO's proposal so far, they are sort of confining that to single resources that request an increase instead of using it as a general gas price or fuel price or benchmark. Then that comes down to the idea of, are they marginal or not, and do they get dispatched or not? And I think either way it affects the market. So I'm not entirely clear why sort of restricting those, if we believe that's the cost of gas in the market, that should be the cost of gas in our cost estimations, I think. But I don't know if I'm really answering your question all that well, but that's as much detail as I have right now, probably.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the way I would describe the tension here is that you have a thinly traded, potentially manipulable index or other source of pricing information, and, one view is that it's dangerous to rely on it to set prices, and the other is that with maybe statistical adjustments and the fact that, the real question is, can we use the information in these markets in ways to pick up market-wide actual, short time frame movements in ways that cannot be endogenously affected by market participants? And I guess it's sort of a question of where the risk aversion falls in terms of, do we try it and then look to see if there are trades that are indicative of attempting to make the index look much more costly than it actually is, or do we wait and see if the ex post review process is failing to pick up a lot of these short-term movements and have to rethink what the automated screen looks like? So I was just looking for, usually I'm used to hearing the concerns about, oh, this is an easily manipulable index, coming from you guys, and it's sort of interesting that you have the opposite stances on this one.
But so one thing I will add, I know in a lot of the analysis that DMM has done, we have we've chosen some kind of line. I think it's in some of the stuff we've put out there, we only talk about doing updates when there are at least a certain number of consummated trades listed, or a certain amount of data, a minimum amount of data available from the same day markets. And I think there are probably some ways we could go down that avenue, looking at sort of maybe price spreads or a minimum number of trades or something like that to refine how frequently we allow those to propagate into the electricity market.
If I may, Jim. So I think some really important things to think about, and if we, I'm happy to continue to unpack this interesting concept of these quote unquote real time trades, as using that to include the three, and I think one of my slides lists them, same day, intraday, Monday only packages. One thing I think is really important is that there's also a question of, is it worth any kind of investment to spend all this time looking at those transactions that are traded on an electronic exchange when the standard industry practice for when it's extremely illiquid and they're looking for actual real-time gas purchases during that time is mostly done either through brokers, if there's a robust broker market, or through actual counterparties. When you look at the volatility and the potential differences in the bid-ask spread that is traded off ICE versus on ICE, there is a difference. And I'll be frank, sometimes when you look at it statistically, sometimes the off ICE market trades at a discount, sometimes it trades at a premium when you look at those. And so what's important is that when you have no transparency, so there's a few things. There's no oversight of the same day intraday and Monday only trades. But more importantly, that's available is rolling averages of some of those products off of the Intercontinental Exchange's electronic trading platform. When you do a similar analysis of looking at off-ICE versus on-ICE trades, even just from a next-day perspective, because again, we use four different gas publishers. We use SNL, Platts, and ICE, and I'm blanking on the fourth one. But so we use three publishers that are based off of reported trades, and we use one that is an electronic trading platform. We talk a lot about ICE because that is what is observable. They provide more transparency. They have a web ICE window where you can see the rolling average of what is being traded in their different products. When you export off of web ICE, it is an aggregate. It provides the product, the strip of the flow dates, the weighted average price, which is the index benchmark, and the lows and highs. And that is what the ISO would have transparency into, that level of information. When we receive that reported from a next day basis from Platts and SNL, where you will get the same information, the lows, the highs, and the average, but the reported indices, they receive a direct feed from ICE, so it will have a strong correlation to the ICE print, but it will also include those off-ICE transactions. And we've looked at, so the ISO has looked at the difference between the highs traded from the reported publishers as well as ICE, and looked at that difference. And the percentages can be different than those that have been represented in purely looking at ICE transactions, because sometimes the off-ICE markets are trading at a premium. And it gets further exacerbated in the real time. Our struggle, and what our struggle has always been to include real time price information, we've been very transparent about this, is that those, because there is no index associated with the same day intraday or Monday only trades, there is no Platts and SNL, those who actually receive reported trades that are off ICE, they don't receive those. The most spot product that is priced is the procurements for timely that are nominated under timely. So any transparency into that off-ICE market through counterparties, we have no observations into. One of the, and the other thing I want to remind stakeholders and the MSC is that we stakeholdered these options under Aliso Canyon Phase 1 in our straw proposal. We stakeholdered the idea of submitting gas price quotes that would be subject to an audit and with the protective influence of the requirement, it cannot submit false or misleading information against creating some kind of real-time price information. That CAISO pursued this aggressively. Was it possible? Could we support it? And we asked stakeholders their opinions, and there was overwhelming discomfort with pursuing a real-time price information because of the question about, is there sufficient liquidity? What are you going to fall back to when it doesn't meet the requirement? Was one of the main challenges. So if there, even if we were to bridge that, the fact that, and the biggest one was stakeholder after stakeholder saying that this information is largely meaningless, what is traded on ICE during the real-time perspective, because almost all of how they handle that volatility is they pick up the phone or they IM or email other counterparties, and it's such an illiquid, volatile time that they're not going onto ICE to try to print and trade on ICE. And so we're in a position of, and that is why the CAISO has taken the position that if we were to include, we are open to talking about including a real-time gas price index in our estimates once a publisher publishes a real-time gas price index, one that would be subject to sufficient oversight as well as would potentially provide the incentive for market participants to move more onto that kind of a platform. It would also allow for a PLAS or one of those indices that index publishers that receive off-ICE transactions to potentially produce those. And that, once we would have transparency into the off-ICE market in real time, that's the very first time I think we would have price information that would even reflect the value of gas.
I understand the issues with the real time, but I continue to focus just on the lag in the day-ahead market, and I don't have the old DMM studies with me, but it seemed to me that there were quite a few days where the difference was more than 10%. So we're setting ourselves up to, you know, we have the information to do it right, but it's not clear, you know, we can test this. I mean, we can, you know, this is something that, of course, we can, you know, do dry run simulations, I guess, and as we think we got an algorithm that works, we can see how often it's going to, you know, the screen's going to work correctly. I assume, you know, you didn't contradict my earlier comment that everybody's going to be able to request this, right? So that every generator that has to buy gas is going to be able to, when it's out of line, he's going to be able to say, I want to get paid the actual price and put in a request.
And it's some of those that are requesting that. This is getting back to sort of what the market power screen ends up looking like. But if you imagine that's a local market power-ish screen, and regionally everybody in the Pacific Northwest is bidding as if gas is $20, but only some of those units are actually being caught by the screen, it seems like there should be a mechanism for that to feed back into the analysis. But the bigger problem is if the gas price anomaly is basically overlapping with the footprint of where the market power screen is catching, and then you really don't have a control group to compare it to.
Perfect. One thing, and then I'm going to kind of wrap up with our final proposal item, is that I think one of our goals that we are pursuing in this effort is we've done an extensive benchmarking of the different design features that all the organized markets have, and we've been working on this for the last several years. Also, the FERC Order 831 has been very helpful, and the comments submitted by all the RTOs, again, has really helped expand and move forward our understanding of what is provided from the organized markets across the country. One of the goals here is we've identified two features that every market provides except for the California ISO. After reviewing it and talking to those markets, we see the benefits and why those were pursued, as well as why they have been approved under their 205 filings. That's this ability to ask for an adjustment from your reference level. Every MISO, New York ISO, and ISO New England all support this flexibility. We view this as a best practice, and we are proposing to pursue including that design flexibility in our design so that we are better aligned with all of the RTOs, ISOs. The second piece is that all of the markets apply some sort of mitigation to their commitment cost components. And so I'm going to kind of segue in the final, and again, I think I emphasize what is very important, because through supporting market-based offers across the entire supply offer subject to mitigation, that reduces the instances that we are concerned that the market design may be overly limiting under uncompetitive conditions. We are proposing mitigation of commitment costs that would allow suppliers to submit market-based commitment cost bids, applying a dynamic market power mitigation test to those market-based commitment cost bids. We are proposing to test critical constraints, and I think we're going to move into some presentations from Scott and Ben, and I think it was really helpful that I'm looking forward to yours, Scott, because I noticed you are going to talk us through some constraint issues. So I did want to highlight that right now what we're thinking is critical constraints, and I'm looking forward to your thoughts on that. Critical constraints are constraints where in the module we see power flows in the prevailing direction at 85% or higher of the line limit. We emphasize that our proposal right now is to include the commitment cost mitigation contingent upon evaluating feasibility and cost. We're going to continue to perform this cost-benefit analysis, but what's really important to us right now at at this juncture in our stakeholder development is to get feedback from the Market Surveillance Committee. Mitigation is a big concern, and this is our proposal. We want to make sure that we're pursuing and proposing something that will provide this help us be able to provide this flexibility, but that continues to address our concerns with market power. As far as the assumptions that we're working from today, is that we are assuming still that from a system perspective, the ISO does not have market power concerns, it's competitive, and that our market power concerns are based on local market power concerns, which is why we continue to focus on transmission constraints. And we do believe that there are lumpy impacts of minimum load energy, which again is why we wanted to broaden the array of constraints that would be tested for whether or not they were competitive to critical constraints. Again, that was 85%. And so those have been some of the concerns that we have thought about and brainstormed, and looking forward to hearing some of your feedback and what you think are best practices that the ISO should consider.
Okay, yep, I'll go first because I have a general overview of principles that the various permutations of this committee have articulated over the years, and then Scott's going to dive into some particulars on some suggestions he has for this proposal, in particular the dynamic mitigation. So it's probably no coincidence that since 2007, I think Kathleen said there were 12 initiatives. Well, we've had 12 opinions. And which means that this November will, whenever we have our next opinion on this, will be the lucky 13, just like this is lucky 13th initiatives. Okay, so this clicker works? Great. So I just have a handful of slides, five slides that articulate the general principles we've said over and over through the years. Some of which are reflected, I think, well in this proposal. That we definitely see some things that are progress. There are a lot of details to be worked out. But I have to preface and say that these opinions were worked on by not just us, but three other people who are not here. Of course, Frank Wallach, the former chair, Stephen Stoft, and Shmuel Oren. And what I put up here, I can't guarantee it's an accurate reflection of the opinions of any particular member. I may be misinterpreting some things. There's a lot of material to go through, but there are definitely some patterns. So these are the 12 opinions, and you'll be relieved to know that I'm not grimly going to march through these and summarize each of them, but there are some that covered both commitment costs and mitigation, some that focus on mitigation, et cetera. So, first, some principles, and then some. Then I'll mention some particular recommendations that we have made. Okay, so some of the principles, and these I think are echoed in what Catherine said are the principles underlying this proposal. That you want to the motivations. We want to reward flexibility. We want people to bid flexibly, not to self-schedule. And there are various ways that the ISO can encourage this, whether dropping bid floors, raising bid ceilings, introducing new products. The pay-for-performance incentive and regulation was an attempt to motivate regulation that moves more quickly. Basically, we want to make sure that it's profitable for generators to offer flexibly. So that means that the bid cost recovery and mitigation systems must allow a recovery of all reasonably anticipatable costs. If we discourage people from bidding in the ISO's markets, then we're not going to have the flexibility that we need. And as Kathleen has articulated, everybody sees a trade-off between assuring cost recovery, giving enough, for example, headroom on caps, and to preventing the exercise of market power in situations where it exists. So we've talked a lot over the years about false positives versus negatives, false negatives, over-mitigating versus under-mitigating, How often do each occur? And what are the consequences if you get it wrong? So if you mitigate a lot, but you've accurately estimated costs, then maybe the consequences aren't very large, for example. But if you mitigate a lot and you're missing a lot of costs, then that will definitely discourage people and distort dispatch. This is one of the reasons we've argued over the years for dynamic market competitive tests, first for energy, and that was implemented, and we've also urged that consideration for commitment costs, which we're now seeing that the ISO is proposing, consistent with what all the other ISOs now do. And that's something at least I personally would welcome. Some of the other principles that we've enunciated, you need caps, but again, we should only try to impose them when the market's insufficiently competitive. So that means some sort of dynamic test. Back in 2007, back at the beginning of MRTU when it was being designed and implemented, we suggested that a pivotable supplier type of test be used for not just energy, but also for commitment costs. So here we are 10 years later, and it looks like we're going to be moving in that direction. So if the test says that a particular market or generator is operating under competitive conditions, then you would relax constraints on what the cap would be and how often it could change. You'd allow more frequent changes. But where there is clearly some potential for market power, you would have tighter constraints. And you want a dynamic test that will be able to fairly accurately detect these conditions. We recognize that dynamic tests for lumpy costs are much more difficult, and the ISO's proposal also recognizes that. And you're going to hear from Scott in a few minutes about one particular approach for doing this, which we've talked about before at previous meetings, or as Scott has introduced. For example, using results from the iterative transmission constraint generation process used in the market to identify when it identifies constraints that are violated, and you can save that information. And if a constraint is never, it has not been identified as being violated in any iteration of the market run, then it's probably not a problem. That's one example of that sort of idea. Through the years, we've seen an expansion of the types of variable costs that should be recognized and calculated, included in the caps. From the very beginning, we said include wear and tear, opportunity costs. The importance of opportunity costs became quite evident when MRTU was introduced, and we had some generators burning through a lot of starts at the very beginning of the summer. Limited starts, which means that would put the system at risk of having those resources unavailable at the end of the summer. That results in an opportunity cost, and as a result, the ISO has responded by proposing implementing an opportunity cost estimation procedure that so you can put an opportunity cost in your into your commitment variables, your startup variables, and also an opportunity cost into energy if you have energy limits over a season. We've recommended that operational flow orders be considered, but of course that's very difficult. So these are examples of the sorts of complications that come up when you're calculating opportunity costs. One opportunity cost of using, for example, starts or run hours early in the season is that you give up some resource adequacy revenues later on, or you risk RIAM penalties. So how should those be factored into opportunity costs? That's a difficult issue, and we spent some time talking about that. Another issue is that gas imbalance penalties are very difficult to anticipate and factor into these. Expected OFO costs, that's a real challenge. And let's see, we've supported, but in a guarded fashion, negotiated caps and after the fact review and recovery. We've articulated concerns that if it's too easy to recover your costs in a non-competitive situation, that this may dampen incentives to minimize those costs. We have, in many of our opinions, we emphasize the importance of careful simulation of the impacts of parameter choices or the impacts of introducing new procedures, how that will affect how often you mitigate and how severely you mitigate. We recognize it's there's an opportunity cost to staff time. This takes a lot of effort, but we really think it's important to be as informed as possible before implementing these procedures. Another principle we've articulated is that any cap should be very flexible and respond to rapidly changing conditions, as we saw in February in the 2013-2014 winter. Scott mentioned the possibility of gas prices going from 5 to 25. So back in 2007, we had suggested a hybrid for caps where those portions of commitment costs that are related to fuels should be changed daily, and there should be very slow changes for other components such as wear and tear, which don't change so much and could be subject to market power. So this is something we've supported all along. So this is my last slide. This is an example of specific recommendations that we've made in these opinions. Over the years, there have been adjustments to bid cost recovery systems to try to enhance incentives to bid flexibly and protect against market power. For example, the separation of day-ahead and real-time BCR calculations and awards, opportunity costs, which I've always mentioned, opportunity costs calculated based on looking ahead weeks or even months when you have a situation where operating hours or starts are limited over a season. A few years ago, we had the very detailed proposal for performance measure and persistent uninstructed energy check to deal with problems of folks deliberately dragging and trying to inflate BCR payments. A lot of parameters went into this. It was a complicated procedure. And we strongly emphasize the need to simulate the impacts of this on the frequency and severity of mitigation with the hope that you'll protect against market power but at the same time not penalize the sort of normal deviations that always occur in markets, even under competitive conditions. Several years ago, Jim led the charge on responding to part of the FERC MRTU order, which asked the MSC to do an assessment of whether three pivotal supplier tests was the right test for local market power. This is in the context of energy rather than the commitment costs. A lot of statistical analysis. Fewer firm conclusions, but there were some conclusions, and one was that going from a three pivotal supplier test to a less conservative two pivotal supplier test definitely posed risks that you did see bids that were significantly in excess of default energy bids, high bids that would have been accepted under a two pivotal supplier test. However, we have to we had to be a little guarded in this conclusion because these bids were made with folks understanding what the present system is for mitigating them. So, if you change the mitigation system, then people may change how they bid. But anyway, that was a remarkable amount of work on Jim's part, and hopefully, you've all read that. I hope you won't cause the ISO's website to crash by immediately going to that part of the website. And finally, more recently, we looked at the issue of EIM mitigation, and that's, as you know, very challenging because there's no must-offer requirement there. At least in some of those markets, they're very concentrated, and there may not be gas indices that are directly relevant to the costs that they're facing. And so, as a result, we have real questions. You know, there are real issues now about encouraging participation in other BA areas. And that's something we're going to hear some more about from Scott in just a little while. And that concludes my presentation. At this point, Scott, you're going to take over the podium, and we'll talk about. You know what, we actually haven't asked if there are questions on Kathleen's presentation or mine. So yeah, thanks for the reminder. Well, first of all, let's ask if there's any reaction in the room, anything you want to address to Kathleen or myself.
I'll just make
I saw two heads being scratched, but those were not hands being raised. Okay. Operator,
Ben,
can you check the phone?
I was just going to add one observation, which
Jim.
Is I think our thinking on, you know, the false positive, false negatives and the risks of that, at least my own, you know, was always influenced by the notion, or it was interacted with our sense of how scarcity pricing was performing. And so when we were talking about energy price bids and the mitigation, it was always, you know, important to make the distinction between a bid mitigation and price mitigation. And if you had scarcity pricing right, you know, the bid mitigation was a little less onerous if you had prices, you know, reflecting the scarcity. Here we've got a trickier situation because when we have startup minimum load costs, to the extent those are recovered in uplift and not in market prices, then, you know, the relationship between that is different and it might color sort of the thinking on, you know, false positive versus false negative risks. The other thing I'll notice is that we're always generous with staff time in our opinions. So.
We're generous with staff time, and we have a heck of a lot of confidence in their capabilities of doing such analyses. So, let's see. Operator? Okay. My talk has bludgeoned them into insensibility, but Scott will wake them up again. Scott.
I've talked about before. You know, the obvious goal we have in mind is the need to mitigate market power by the potential for the exercise of market power by entities that potentially have location market power, but at the same time, as Kathleen's talked about, providing resources and the flexibility to accurately reflect their costs in the market. And the preferred approach we'd like is to give market participants the flexibility, but we need to preclude the use of flexible offers to enable people to exercise locational market power. So that is the constraint that we're dealing with. And what, you know, has, you know, we deal with the, in general with the potential for the exercise of locational market power by applying the pivotal supplier test, both within the California ISO and the Western EIM, and applying mitigation when we see a lack of competition within a constrained region. And one of the complications that makes commitment costs historically different in the way they're treated than incremental energy costs is there's a concern that not only could excessive startup and minimum load costs effectively economically withhold capacity from the market and raise energy prices, which would be captured by the pivotal supplier test, they also could transfer wealth by inflating uplift costs. So even if a constraint wasn't binding, the inflated offers could transfer income from ratepayers in general, transmission customers in general, to the entities submitting the inflated bids. And that made it more complicated because that can occur even if there is no transmission constraint binding. And even if you had a good allocation scheme in the EIM, for example, you allocated the uplift cost to the region in which the uplift costs occurred, you'd still potentially have cost shifting between load-serving entities within the constrained region. Now, the The current California approach to dealing with this problem, as Kathleen indicated, is different from the way we deal with energy, because basically we always apply mitigation to estimated cost plus 25%. And the 25% has been varied over time, but as Kathleen also pointed out, you start making the margin bigger, then you're basically, those people who do have market power get to exercise it to some degree. So, yeah, you can deal with the variations and the inability to reflect cost to a degree by providing a bigger margin, but that's also undermining the very reason you're having mitigation in the first place, which is to preclude the exercise of locational market power. Now, the problem with applying this mitigation all the time, as Kathleen indicated, is that it affects not only the ability of firms to recover their costs, but it reduces the benefits of EIM participation for entities that are joining it if they foresee the potential for them to incur a bunch of costs that they're not going to be able to recover in the market, and they're going to have to ask their ratepayers or their utility commission to recover from their ratepayers. And one of the consequences of that can be particularly since the EIM has some degree of voluntariness, that they can change the resources that they offer in the market or not offer in the market. Now, you still have to provide the various ramp capabilities, so the ability to withhold resources from the market is limited at times, but still they can choose which resources and, if some resources are more exposed to being committed uneconomically, they may shift which resources they use for meeting reserves or regulation, even when it's not completely efficient, but to avoid these uneconomic cost shifts due to inefficient mitigation. So this is particularly as the CAISO becomes more important in the West, that we're not just managing the California grid, but we're taking on the role of the Western grid operator, and we want to continue to make that attractive for utilities across the West. We have to think about these broader issues. Now, there are a number of, many steps the CAISO can take to do better. So, and I'm not possibly going to talk about all of them. I thought I'd talk about three that were a good starting point. One, which is just to try to do better in measuring commitment costs. So that's the cost. We'll continue to mitigate based on our estimated costs, but we can try to do better in how we estimate those costs. The second is one of the avenues Kathleen talked about, which is to try more to limit the application of mitigation. So effectively today, our design for commitment costs is we always mitigate them. We always constrain them to estimated costs plus 25%. A way to limit the potential for uneconomic commitments is to try to only apply the mitigation where we really have a potential for the exercise of market power. And that gets into the problem I just outlined of, well, what about the inflated cost to transfer wealth? So that's the tension is, how do we deal with that? I mean, one approach to that is to try to have a broader test and not only look at whether a transmission constraint is binding in the actual energy dispatch, but to reach back further and see, is there any possibility that the constraint caused the commitment of a resource, even if the constraint then became non-binding once the resource was committed. And that's one of the approaches that indirectly the CAISO was talking about. And then in thinking about this and listening to stakeholder talks and various talks with the MSC, I began thinking that, another way to get at this also may be to take advantage of the fact that when we're dealing with commitment costs and uplift, we're worried about uplift costs. Uplift costs don't have to be mitigated ex ante. And a lot of other ISOs take advantage of that in their designs when they recognize that when we're committing somebody out of merit and his costs aren't going to be reflected in the market, it's going to show up in uplift costs, or we're committing him for local reliability, it's going to show up in uplift costs. You don't have to mitigate that at the time. You can apply the mitigation after the fact, because it isn't impacting market prices, and uplift, that's billed at the end of the month or later. So you've got time to apply other checks to it. So part of this third idea is to take advantage of that. Now, I thought I'd peel down a little bit more on each of these three approaches, and the CAISO has already taken a lot of steps to improve the measurement of costs. It has been you know, listed four or five of the changes, and Kathleen's been occupied full time for about 3 years on one change after another to improve this. So that's been an ongoing effort now, and part of this effort today is to make some additional changes to base it on mitigation on negotiated value and other submissions by the market participant. You know, the thing that, you know, my questions that I was raising before, I am troubled by, you know, California is unique because we sit in the West, the gas market's clearing 3 hours earlier. So, you know, California has had this, you know, it isn't what any other ISO is doing to look at the actual early morning results and take advantage of it, but it is like our competitive advantage. You know, that's one thing we've got that the rest of the ISOs don't, is because we're in the West, we've got that information. So I thought it was really clever and good that the ISO was able to use that, and DMM's analysis, you know, has shown that it seems to have taken care of a lot of things. So that's, you know, we have to think about how these new improvements are going to do relative to that. But even, you know, with all the improvements Kathleen has talked about, and some of the, you know, there some of the, you know, problems she mentioned are not going to be avoidable. You know, we're not all gas-fired generation is located at liquid trading points. There's no way we're going to get a good measure for some of these gas-fired generations because they're on the other side of a constrained pipeline from where the gas is traded. You know, we're lucky in California. That's, again, the difference between the CAISO and the broader EIM, because the CAISO gas utilities are so large and the way the trading has evolved, we've got pretty good gas price indexes for that reflect the cost of the gas-fired generation, and that isn't going to be true across the West, and there's nothing we can do about it. It just is going to be that way. And as she pointed out, there's not going to be liquidity at some of those trading points, no matter what we do. And then even at some of the locations where maybe there is liquid trading for day-ahead gas at that location, the volume in real time and the volume at any particular time is going to be very low, so no matter how good and how much time we spend on it, we're never going to get a very good liquid measure price index for intraday transactions. And then the third problem we got is sometimes yeah, there is trading, but because of the timing and the nature of it, it isn't taking place on ICE. You know, my understanding, and other people have told me the same thing, is that weekend trades for gas flowing on Monday don't take place on ICE, and in part because their traders are not allowed to trade from their home. And even their national gas trading companies that have a 24-hour shop, they're manning on the weekend, but they're calling people at their home to do the deals. So it's not going to be an ICE traded deal, even for the people, the gas trading companies that are running 7 days a week. And that's specifically going to be a problem for Monday, because on Saturday and Sunday, the deals, when people realize that, oh my God, Monday is going to be awful, they're doing deals on Saturday and Sunday at very high prices, and they're never going to be on ICE. So we're never going to capture them. So the issues that Kathleen brought up of going beyond just trying to do better, I think, are important, because doing better is never going to solve all the problems. So the other part has got to be, I think, of doing what going down the ride the CAISO was talking about, of is trying to only apply mitigation when we actually have the potential for the exercise of market power. So we're still going to fail in those cases where someone has market power and it's Monday and or it's at a location where there's a illiquid gas market, but, you know, that's a lot more limited. So if we can limit the exercise of the mitigation to those circumstances when people actually have locational market power, that will enable potentially an improvement in the design and limit the extent to which we're inefficiently mitigating people, and particularly in the context of the EIM, I think, to not be mitigating people to support exports when there is no market power and we're mitigating them and then the power is being exported, so there's a cost shift from that utility's ratepayers to ratepayers elsewhere. If we're mitigating them because they have local market power, then it's probably, even though it's not perfect and there could be some transfer, a lot of the costs are going to fall right within that BAA, and it isn't going to be such a transfer issue. So what is one of the approaches that we've talked about? This is within the scheme of what Kathleen talked about and Ben brought up, is we've talked for a year or so about the idea of, well, we're concerned about a constraint that caused the commitment of a resource with high startup and minimum load costs and that showing up in uplift, but it's got to at some point, even if that resource, once it's committed, relieves the constraint, at some point that constraint was enforced in the unit commitment. And therefore, it should, in the conventional design of these things, be that constraint should be among the set that are calculated, the flows that are calculated, the power flow, among the set that's enforced when they're doing the dispatch. So even though it's not binding in the dispatch, we should be able to say, yes, that constraint at least potentially caused this unit to be committed. You can't be sure it caused a unit committed. That would be require, you know, a bunch of reruns to see what happened. But you could narrow it down and say at least, well, it's completely impossible if this constraint caused that unit to be committed, because this constraint never bound. And that's kind of what, in the spirit of what Kathleen was talking about, because, and you know, how you implement this is all, you know, all up to what's easy, but the idea of, okay, if the flows were never more than 85% of the, or not more than 85% of the limit in the solution, you might say, well, that's a pretty good indication that it never bound. And I don't know that that's necessarily true, but it's something that you could, you know, study and see if that's a good approximation. And if it is, it would be a way to not apply mitigation to resources that could not possibly have been exercising market power because they weren't committed to solve any constraint. So that's, I think that's a good road to go down if we can, to limit the, if we're concerned about inflated uplift costs, if that's the market power problem we haven't resolved because we know how to deal with the apply the pivotal supplier test when it's buying in the energy market. One way to look, you know, and narrow the scope is to say, well, was this unit committed to solve a constraint or not? And if it wasn't, don't mitigate it. And I think that's worth going down. And it gets at the goals Kathleen was talking about of solving the problem of improper, of, you know, difficult mitigation by not mitigating resources that don't have any potential to be exercising market power. You know, the second bullet, though, there is a tough part to figure out, well, you know, empirically, is this going to work? And I don't know. You know, it may turn out that we look at, you know, where the flow is 85% of the limit, we may find out just because of the degree of dispatch and flows across the ISO that's going to be true 95% of the time. So, you know, we can't be sure this is going to be kicking the ball through the goalposts or not. You know, we may find that this is just not going to have that much impact. So it's something that I think is worth pursuing, but we need to not declare victory. We have to make an assessment of how much difference is this going to make. Is it really going to make enough difference in outcomes that it's worth going down this road? And this is the approach we should choose. So that rolls me over. Well, let me stop here and see if there are any questions in the room about these two approaches and maybe check the phones as well. Okay, go to the phone then.
Marvin, can you go ahead and put the question through on the phone?
This is Mo Sakita with Arizona Public Service. I just have a quick comment about the Monday package that Mr. Javi was talking about. It's not like the traders are doing the trades on a Saturday or a Sunday from their homes. These trades are done on a Friday, but the Monday package alone is really non-standard, and that's why traders are forced to pick up the phone and call the producers directly to procure the Monday package alone. And given that,
the ICE does have a Monday only trade, and I've discussed that with gas trading companies in the East extensively, and there is a Monday-only trade on ICE that you could do, and we ask why don't you do it, and basically they have rules that their compliance shops won't let them trade on ICE from home. And so that's why I see we get this breakdown of they're on the phone instead of on ice because it's the weekend and people are at home. And they do, I understand, the problem with the three-day trade is that doesn't reflect the true Monday price. And then when you get into the Monday-only trades, yes, some of those are done during the prior week, and those are fine on ice. But then when you get to the weekends that are really bad, they're at home, they're doing trades from home, the price is really high, and we don't have it.
Yeah, I'm speaking on behalf of Arizona Public Service, and I'm just telling you what usually happens. Yes, Monday's package is usually available, or often not available on ice, but it's very illiquid, and the producer are hesitant to show any numbers for Monday only. So that's why the traders are forced to pick up the phone on a Friday and procure the products for Monday. And usually, typically on a premium, at least 20-25% premium to the three-day package.
Right. Yeah, I expect it to be a premium because that's when the load is, so that people are going to...
Exactly. All right. That's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on the phone? Is that it? Any questions in the room? Okay. So as I prefaced in the introducing, you know, I was thinking about this and talking it over with the MSC and people at the CAISO and rattling things around. And, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, since we're focused on uplift costs as the real problem with the current design, and we have a design that's capable of identifying the exercise of local market power when it binds in the energy market, maybe we ought to think, you know, really focus on that distinction and whether we can use that to limit the scope of automatic mitigation and limit it to when we really have a potential for market power and it's being exercised. So the idea would be to apply mitigation basically using our conventional pivotal supplier test for constraints that are binding in the energy market so that when we have a binding transmission constraint, but apply commitment cost mitigation after the fact in the calculation of uplift payments. Now, this would, you know, the way I think about this is it goes down the same approach of what Kathleen was doing of what we're going to do is we're going to get better by not applying mitigation when we don't need to, ex ante, but still achieving our goal of precluding the exercise of locational market power, both, you know, neither to raise energy market prices or to raise uplift costs. Now, when I got talking and thinking about this and running it through people, we broke it down. There are four possible scenarios. We got a constraint that binds in our TPD, and the resource is committed, or it binds and the resource is not committed, or the constraint doesn't bind, and then either the resource is committed or the resource is not committed. So you can sort of say, okay, those are the cases, and let's see how our design works in each of those. Well, first, if the constraint binds and a resource is committed, well, because the constraint binds, we're going to trigger our normal mitigation. The three pivotal supplier test will be applied. We'll decide whether this person has market power, and if they do, we know they should be subjected to locational mitigation. And if they're committed, once that mitigation is triggered, we'd be mitigating both their incremental energy offers, and we could then apply mitigation to the startup and minimum load cost as well. And that would not be changing the current philosophy. We'd be using the three pivotal supplier tests. All you'd be doing is applying the mitigation to the commitment cost at the same time you're applying it to the incremental energy offers. Then the second scenario is it binds in the RTP solution, the resource is not committed, but because it binds, the constraint binds, we apply a market power test. If this resource is market power, then we go back and rerun it with the mitigated bids, and then we'd find out. Maybe the resource would still not be committed because it really just isn't economic. It's got a, you know, terrible shift factor on the resource, and it's a really inefficient way to mitigate it to solve the constraint, or maybe it would be. Maybe it would turn out that those costs would have led to inflated uplift costs, but we'd be committing them based on the default energy bids and the whatever we call them the estimated commitment costs and in the physical dispatch. And then you know, we'd get the outcome we wanted. Maybe the constraint would be non-binding with the mitigated, or maybe just uplift costs would go down. So that's the second case, and that works. But of course, those two cases were easy because we had the energy market constraint binding. Now let's get to the next case where the constraint does not bind in the energy market dispatch and the resource is committed. So here we've got the potential we're really worrying about. There's no constraint binding, so the mitigation wouldn't be triggered. But this person could have known that, well, you're going to have to commit me, and my minimum load block is such that once you commit me, the constraint's going to go away. I'm going to bid one arm and two legs and up in startup and minimum load costs, so I'm going to extract a lot of money from the system. So these offers could be excessive. But it was committed. The energy market price was not affected because the energy market constraint was non-binding, so there's no impact on the energy market. So we don't need to mitigate this person's commitment bids ex ante. We could let them put in whatever market-based bids they wanted, and since the pre-pivotal supplier test didn't trigger because there was no energy market constraint, we could catch up with them later and mitigate them in the uplift calculation. And it's exactly what other ISOs do for a lot of resources that are committed for local reliability. You know, they don't need to mitigate the bids at the time, or they don't need to have their screens trigger that ex ante. They're just noted that the resource is committed for local reliability, and uplift cost mitigation is applied when they send out the invoices.
Scott, is it possible that a strategic bid by this unit, if taken away, could create congestion elsewhere?
But then there'd be another constraint somewhere else that bound, and we'd apply the mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see a problem here. This seems to me to we've gotten through three of the four cases, and the current California ISO design would work fine. This would mean that we'd need to have standards for applying the mitigation after the fact, but it would be even easier to do it because then you wouldn't have to worry about whether there were trades in ICE. You could actually look at, you know, the actual gas acquisition costs. And if you thought there was something wrong with those gas acquisition costs, fine. You could use some measure of what they were, but it would all be after the fact when you have more information.
Yeah, sorry, this is Mike from DMM. You kind of just mentioned this, Scott, but I think the big challenge here would be differentiating between when that resource was committed for local reliability and when it was, say, a system commitment when there was actually some scarcity or something like that where we wouldn't normally mitigate a price or an offer.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Even if we mitigated them all the time, that still would be no worse than the current system, because right now we're mitigating them and we may commit them uneconomically and then mitigate them. Here, you know, at least they get a chance to, if it's for exports, they wouldn't be they might not be committed based on their true costs. But if they are, you know, you're right, it isn't perfect because, you know, sometimes they might be committed for, but they'd have been committed based on their true costs. So we'd have to be, we might mitigate them down, but we'd be able to do at least as good a job as we do today because we could use all the information we use today to estimate the costs, plus we'd have the ability to look at information we can't look at today because we're doing it after the fact. Kathleen?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. This is awesome. I'm just curious, when you're talking about the after the fact part, and since this is kind of a new discussion point, I wanted to get, are you envisioning something like applying a conduct and impact test approximation, or can you talk a little bit more about how you would see that working?
Well, this could be, maybe we just do it the same way we do it, but if you're committed and we just mitigate we always mitigate your commitment costs, because even that would be better than the current system, because no one would be worse off. And if we just said we're always going to mitigate you when we commit you, and you have uplift costs, we're always going to recalculate the uplift costs based on, you know, our estimated costs, that would still be better. And we could, both in terms of we wouldn't always be mitigating people, we'd only be mitigating people when we actually committed them, and we'd have the ability to use later information, which for things like gas trades, we would have better information later. There might be some things that, yeah, this wouldn't deal with. If it was intraday and thin and we discounted their number somewhat, we could still be fairer than we can trying to do it in advance. And this, in the end, it becomes sort of like the same as the proposal that CAISO has, where we're going to have this true-up after the fact for people that are committed uneconomically. So this would be, but this would only apply to, only need to be applied to up to the uplift, not when in any other situation. So I think, you know, you can sort of cookie-cutter this and say whatever rules we'd use for the under the ISO proposal, we could use under this design as well.
But the difference is the ISO would do the mitigation and then reverse it ex post, and you're describing the opposite, where we just let it go through and then you reverse
right.
it on the uplift payment.
Yeah. Right. And the difference is really that we then get case four. Well, you know, okay, so I think we went through that. Okay, so then the difference is, no. I'm sorry, this is case four. It's approach three, case four, got myself confused. So this is the case where does not bind in the dispatch solution and the resource is not committed. So conceivably, this person economically withheld their supply by putting in really high bids, but this is the case where the energy market constraint didn't bind. So it had no impact on the energy market because there was no transmission constraint they were sitting behind. And then because the constraint didn't bind and they weren't committed, there also aren't any uplift costs because they didn't get committed. So it seems to me that, and this is the key case, because this is the case where we're mismeasuring their costs. We commit them not to solve a local transmission constraint, but to support exports to another balancing authority area, and then we don't make them whole. So this, you know, this seems to be, in this case, we'd still, you know, if they were needed to solve a local problem, we're back in case three, we would have committed them, there'd be uplift, we'd mitigate them, they couldn't extract any uplift costs from the rest of the world. If there was a binding transmission constraint, we're back in case one and two, and they'd have to pass the pivotal supplier test. So the key here is we're in a case where there's no energy market constraint binding, so there's no market power being exercised in the energy market because they're not being committed drove up the energy market price because the transmission constraint didn't even bind. There it's a EIM-wide price. And then we don't have uplift costs because we didn't commit them. Yep.
Hi, it's Mike from DMM again. So you're talking about the transmission constraint binding in the final, sort of the binding interval dispatch solution? In the
We're talking in the market power test, obviously. So.
Okay. So, yeah, so the... Okay. I mean, depending on how that works out exactly, though, if there are multiple resources behind the constraint, you want to be able to catch the situation where the constraint doesn't bind because sort of the next most expensive resource or next least expensive resource got dispatched instead of this one, right?
Right, but I mean, it didn't affect the energy market price because it didn't bind. Even if it, you know, it was a case where they withheld their supply and they forced a higher energy market price because the constraint bind, then we're back in the first two cases where the constraint binds, we apply the pivotal supplier test. But this is the case where even when they're not committed, the constraint doesn't bind.
Right, but if they're not committed because a different resource is committed and we're maybe getting
right.
a...
But even if the other resource set the price, if the other resource set the price and the constraint bound, then we'd be applying mitigation. So this is the...
Right, but say the other resource has an opportunity cost and they're able to get a different resource committed early in the summer a bunch of times so that the energy prices will be higher later on in the summer when that opportunity cost resource is used up. We could still have a situation that we want to be able to make sure we catch, I think.
So this is that we, everybody, they're going to try to inflate their costs to recover their costs, because they're only, the unit that gets forced on is only recovering their approved estimated cost, right? And it's uplift.
Right.
Because they're getting their uplift costs.
I think you're describing maybe a specific manifestation scenario in which market power is more than just local. And, you know, if that's an issue, then all of this has some shortfalls. But I guess
but if it's more than local, the federal supplier test has shortfalls.
Oh, sure. Exactly. No, that's what I meant by all this. But I guess also I'm just trying to think through the other LMPM issues. If it causes another local unit to be dispatched that just has higher costs,
mm-hmm.
then the second unit would not be mitigated, but this unit would be? Or
well, if the energy constraint, if you caused another unit to be dispatched to solve the constraint, and the constraint were binding,
then you would be back in case one, and you would mitigate this unit, and that second unit would go away again.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
If the unit that was forced on was lumpy, and so the constraint, now the constraint was generated earlier, but now is not binding, what would happen there? You'd have
then they're just uplift. You see, there's no impact on the market price.
No impact on market price.
And the person that bid high didn't get any uplift either.
It might be more uplift than if the uncommitted unit was mitigated. If the uncommitted unit was actually the cheaper way of meeting.
If the uncommitted unit was the more expensive way, but we estimated its cost as being low, then yes, the price will. That's the point. But we'll no longer get uneconomically committed units.
All right, Kathleen's being patient, but
I got one more.
Oh, yeah, thank you. So I know you have a couple more slides, but this seems like the right time.
No, this year.
I did have a question that I wanted to get direct feedback on, and I think Mike has teed it up well, and Jim, thank you so much for catching that, is that I laid out in my presentation, and I wanted to be very clear, we're moving forward on assumptions. These assumptions are system is competitive. Local market power is the concern in the ISO footprint and the expanding EIM. We haven't changed that assumption. And then, of course, the lumpy effect. I feel like we've landed and repeated the lumpy part a lot. And so that, to me, I feel very confident and comfortable that there's consistency and consensus on that. It's the first two assumptions that I feel like we need to talk a little bit about. Because right now the CAISO's position is we have not seen anything to move us away from system is competitive, local maybe uncompetitive given the way that we're set. And that's also why we're moving in the same direction of the three pivotal supplier tests. Seems based on all the content that you guys have produced, we're feeling confident that this is moving in the right direction. But if those assumptions break down, then that brings up different questions. So you even just caught that, Jim, and said it sounds like what we're talking about is, are there system concerns?
Can I just do some definition check? So by system now, we are talking about the entire, all EIM sub-areas and so forth. And yeah, I wondered if we need a new sort of distinction for EIM sub-area, assuming there's maybe congestion on interties, but not intra-EIM sub-area. But when for now, just when we're saying system, we're saying there's no intertie congestion into that area. Okay.
Yeah, and we might want to think about, what region we'd use. Like if there was export congestion, if there was congestion into port, into Pacific Corp West, and then also then into all the utilities north of them, so that there'd be a big super region that we'd say we'd mitigate in that. Or would you say that was big enough? I mean, that would be a decision that could be made, but, this would say that all those resources are behind that constraint. They'd have to pass the pivotal supplier test. If there's enough competition, they should pass the pivotal supplier test, so we'd, our design would actually take care of that.
Brad? Scott, in this example, I'll get into what Ben was saying. So what if a resource bids higher than it should, and it's not committed, and then so alternatively, the market commits a resource with a little bit more expensive commitment costs, and it's lumpy. The commitment is lumpy, so it relieves the constraint. So the first resource wasn't committed, but it should have been if it bid its cost. And then we've committed a slightly more expensive unit, which is bidding its real cost, and there's nothing to mitigate. Would that add additional cost to the market? It wouldn't. Maybe that unit didn't affect energy prices, but it added to the cost because the unit that was committed.
But it wasn't due to market power. It was only due to the fact that the units has a different view of its cost than you do. And that goes back to Kathleen's premise that who's better able to figure out its costs, the operator of the unit or us based on these estimates?
You're saying the first unit wasn't trying to exert market.
Well, they don't. There's no benefit to them. So if they were raising the energy market price or they were getting uplift costs, but in the end, all the uplift is going to be based on the commitment cost mitigation. So
I see. You're saying there's no one would try to exert market power and commitment costs because if you are that more expensive unit that bid too high and you were committed, then you'd be mitigated exposed.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Brad, just kind of adding, I think another thing that at least I'm reading a little bit into is that if the only incentive would be if you were to do that on a portfolio basis, but you would have then had to have had some of your resources committed. So it falls into the scenario that he raised where you are committed, we are now looking at you after the fact. You would be able to look at it from a portfolio basis because that is a type of principle if we do it on a portfolio basis. So his concern, the incentives are only there if you at least had one of your resources committed, and then we would after the fact.
I wasn't assuming there's two different resources had the same owner. I was just
Then I think that makes a lot of sense. I also think just adding if we could do a little bit of an advantage on approach two, because I think that might be more kind of where the Kaiser was moving from, and advantage there is it may capture. It helps to have a little bit more market power protection, but maybe have some over-mitigation is a disadvantage. Whereas I think I'm checking my comprehension. Approach three is it has a sufficient level of market power protection, but it helps to mitigate for the risk of over-mitigation. Is that how you see these approaches?
Right, I'm not sure about the path with approach two. Path two might end up being exactly the same as this, but I'm not sure it will be, it might be difficult to find a threshold that both prevents the exercise of market power and also doesn't always result in the same thing happening, and that's what I'm just not sure about, that we're going to be able to pick a number that's going to work. But yeah, it could be that approach two would work out to be just as effective as this, but I'm not sure we can count on that. Yep.
Weizhou from IC. I'm just wondering a question. I don't know who I should ask. Maybe ISO, maybe DMN or MSC. So I think the assumption about the system is competitive, we only need to concern about the local kind of uncompetitive condition. I think that assumption is critical. So I'm wondering if that assumption is not correct or somewhat not reflecting the reality, then all this approach may fail or not effective. So I'm wondering if there's a way to test this assumption when we talk about all the different kinds of approaches.
Well, you have to ask if it is true that system has market power, then we've got bigger problems in a sense. But so it's almost as if, is there something special about commitment costs and system market power that's different than, say, energy? Because I think we've all been operating under the assumption that the energy markets, or at least energy bidding, is competitive in the system wide, and it doesn't, all the analyses DMN has done and so forth seems to support that. So it's a real question of whether there's something about commitment costs and the interaction of that that makes it different than what we think about with bidding on that system level assumption.
Well, when I look at the commitment cost, I'm more thinking about the conventional resources. The commitment cost would be more applicable to conventional resources, like a solar wind. They're difficult to It could be some cost, but not as huge as gas units or thermal units. So with the system, the resource mix continue to change. I don't know if that assumption is still true. I just wonder where you they were to test the assumption, because you said it's an assumption, it's not a fact, right?
Well, I think, the test that we've sort of been following, it seems like, is an ex post type of analysis that DMM does and others sort of, looking at different ways to try to measure the benchmarking and other sorts of measures that are trying to get at a sense of how the market performed historically relative to certain types of benchmarks we could come up with. So in essence, they're running it against the dev kind of hypothetical already. I don't know if they extend that analysis to uplift, costs and those sorts of things. But there are, there's a lot of this calculation that's done, and it seems to be arguing, if anything, that generation is not recovering as much as what you would have thought.
Should we check the phone? Okay. Is there anyone in the room that wants to? And I don't know that the next couple slides are basically just, there isn't much substance here, just sort of making the, raising the question, what do we clearly want to pursue the improvements that Kathleen's talking about. I think they're important. My view is that the kind of improvements she's talking about might be totally as effective as the approach three. It's just hard to know. It'd be something to study, and thinking about it, I think that this other approach might have some virtue, particularly for the wider EIM area and making reducing the likelihood we'd be committing resources for to support exports and leaving the utility to recover costs from its ratepayers. And I think that's a lot of the concern, because committing a resource uneconomically to deal with local market power probably isn't going to be as big an issue, because it's going to get recovered from the local market anyway. But I think when we're committing them for exports and costs are getting shifted from other BAAs onto the BAA that's got the resources, there's going to be a temptation for them to, well, I'm worried about this resource not recovering its costs, so I'll take it out of the mix. And that's not what we want, because we want we're all better off the more resources are in the mix. And so that's where I am.
Okay. Yes. Scott, you laid out three approaches that you see alternative two and three being mutually exclusive?
No, but I mean, you might not need to implement both, but right, they're not. None of these approaches are exclusive, and I assume that everything will be done. We do as much as we can on approach one. We'll do as good as we can to estimate the cost correctly, but in common with a lot of what Kathleen said, I see a lot of limits to. We're not going to get that perfect. We got to recognize that we're going to fail. So we want to have some other methods to limit the damage when we misestimate the costs.
And between two and three, do you think, are there studies or other things that should be done to provide us a better basis for choosing between those, whether we should be in approach two, comparing that to Kathleen's 85% threshold, for example, as to which approach would be better in the dynamic screen? What are there studies that you would suggest?
And the easiest place to study it would be in the day-ahead market, to run some cases and see, what kind of situations we got. And then, but, that only works for the CAISO. It doesn't really work for the EIM. So, there we kind of have to look at RTB cases and choose some and look at the level of flows. I mean, it actually shouldn't be too difficult to sort of look at the typical level of flows on these constraints and see. But I, that's where I get worried that
85% might actually, when we're the big constraints between the BAA is that even we're not committing units that cause that constraint to be non-binding, but 85% might be, you know, that's normal operations. And, you know, the extra 15% is 500 megawatts or something. But, you know, so maybe approach two would turn out that if we start studying it, maybe we'd have to, you know, start using 85% for small constraints and 90% for others or 95, and that might get complicated or it might be, you know, okay. But I suspect that that's what we'd find out, that if we used 85% for everything, we'd probably find we're triggering all the time, but it might be possible to.
Do you envision under approach three that the kind of a clawback of the uplift payments would be formulaic or upon an intervention?
No, I assume it'd be just like today. They'd just be like the user substituting the
just plug it in and pay that. So the process of appeal would be very similar. That's what's proposed by the
ISO. I'm saying, you know, let's take everything else that Kathleen's proposed and just use, you know, all those procedures we're going to use. You know,
mm-hmm.
Use them.
Just checking, operator, is there anybody? Could we check to see if anybody would like to make a question on the, or make a comment on the line right now?
Again, you can press #2 on your telephone keypad if you do have a question at this time. And there are currently no questions.
Okay.
Carrie Bentley with the Western Power Trading Forum. Scott, I think I caught that you said you thought approach three and approach two might end up being really similar. In the circumstance that they're similar, is it only because of, I guess, bullet three, where the constraint does not bind an RTP solution and the resources committed? Would they approach, I guess, more parity depending on that ex-ante treatment? A little confused on why you thought.
Well, if approach two ends up not mitigating for resources that are not committed because of a constraint and only mitigates resources that are committed because they're needed to clear a constraint, then it'll end up being very similar. But they're, you know, because it's those are the resources we're concerned about the inappropriate mitigation of. The resources that are being committed to solve a constraint, we're going to have to mitigate them.
All right. Let's see. Let's take a lunch break. And let's take it for an hour. Whenever I've asked for a 45-minute lunch break, but people have tended to dribble in at 50, 55. So, on the other hand, I do have a flight to catch this evening. Let them dribble. Does anybody object to 45 minutes to make a shorter lunch break and being able to leave earlier? You'd rather spend 15 minutes at home than here in the lunchroom, I presume. Okay, so we'll take 45 minutes and we will start even if there's nobody here. So, okay, see you then at 1:15. Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome back from lunch. Myself, Jim Bushnell, and Scott Harvey are the Market Surveillance Committee of the California ISO. And this afternoon we have two items in the agenda. And Perry's video is going to be making both presentations, one on contingency modeling enhancements and then subsequently on generator contingency and remedial action schemes. So let's do the first one, and then we'll have some discussion with the MSC and stakeholders, and then we'll go to the second item. Perry, it's all yours.
All right. Thank you, Ben. I'm Perry Servideo, Senior Market Design Policy Developer here at the ISO. I'm going to present some of our CME results that we've been working on since the last MSC meeting that we went to, and that was in February. Lynn will be here shortly to answer any technical questions about these results that may come up. Okay, so we finalized the results from our technical analysis scenarios. Recall the original scope of the analysis was to find some stressed scenarios, different times of year, get all of the CME contingencies in there and enforce the then see what happens. Validate, we presented at the February MSC meeting showing that 11 of 12 scenarios were non-binding, and there was one binding scenario on San Diego's peak load day in 2016. We also left you guys hanging on the exact results for three of those non-binding scenarios because we needed to run them with the new software patch. So we got those updated into the table in here. The next thing we did was we ran CME in parallel to operations, in parallel to our production environment for 2 weeks at the end of March and beginning of April. The goal here was to see how often we could see CME binding, perhaps in a real world situation, just day in, day out. We'll then talk about policy impacts, and just I'll highlight some high level bullets on that, and then we're hoping to get MSC thoughts on all of this stuff. There is one other thing I added to the end of this, and that is we ran CME in the real-time market. The goal there was, because you guys asked what would happen if CME couldn't clear less load. So we thought, okay, well, let's take that binding day from San Diego and let's dive into the real-time market, run real-time, then you can't clear less load, so let's see what it would do. And we have those results in this presentation also. Okay, so we have the 12 technical analysis scenario, the original scoped technical analysis. What you're looking at here is 11 results, or results from 11 of those scenarios. The 12th is the binding case that we reviewed at the meeting in February. What is highlighted here in yellow are the data that was missing last time that we talked to you guys. So you can, this was as expected. You have a capacity requirement that is less than your post-contingency rating, there's enough unloaded capacity to resolve that capacity requirement in each of the cases. So it's a result, even though it's kind of an uninteresting result and expected result for these three. So we're going to release these results in a final technical analysis report. Lynn can maybe give you a sense on timing on that. We're hoping to get that out pretty soon so that's in time for an MSC opinion for CME. And from the ISO perspective, these indicate that the CME constraints may rarely bind in the market. Keep in mind that the 12 scenarios you ran here were stressed scenarios. So, you know, we took the most stressed days we could find in these seasons for these constraints. We ran it and it only binds in 1 out of 12 of these scenarios.
Kurt, remind me, were these days when in actual operations the operators thought the mock constraints were binding and they did take actions in real life?
Yeah.
Okay. So the inference we should draw, that I draw, is that modeling it accurately gives us the operators better information about whether they need to take action so that we can save uplift costs by not taking actions that we don't really need to when we look at the constraint more accurately. Is that a correct reading?
Yeah, and there's also another piece to this, and that is on these days what it tells us is that we would not need, the operations team would not have needed to enforce the MOC on that day. And the MOC, of course, then impacts what happens in the commitment and everything. So you get rid of that, you put the right constraint into the market, and then you may have something that rarely binds. So operator didn't need to take action, and we didn't need to have an MOC enforced in the market, and the operations team is happy. Okay, so then we ran the preventive corrective model in parallel to production. I believe it was from March 22nd through April 5th, around that time, 2 weeks at the end of March, beginning of April. And over that two-week period, CME did not bind any hour of any day. And this was just a day ahead. We ran it in day ahead market. These further indicate that CMAQ's constraints may rarely bind once we're using them in the market.
Do you know if any MOC like constraints were activated during these times?
Yeah, there, on a few of the days there were MOCs activated. So at least one of the days we had a San Diego MOC in, and a few other days there were other MOCs to which the operations engineers would try to convert into a CME type contingency and run it in here.
Do you characterize any of these days as stress? As stressful in any way?
I can't answer that question. I would say, I mean, it's sort of during outage season there, so from an outage standpoint, it might be stress, but I don't know if it's stress from like a system load or you know, generation availability standpoint.
So one thought that came up this morning was whether there's a way to quantify the difference between the world with the CME that wasn't binding and the world in which the MOCs were actually being deployed by maybe calculating the differences in the production costs or uplifts or something like that, either over this two-week span or over the 9 to 12 scenarios that you were that you looked at. Were you guys already doing something like that, or is there...
Yeah, so that's the other thing that you guys asked us to look into in the February meeting. That's the last piece of this overall analysis that we have not reported back to you guys on. We're trying to complete that in the next 1 or 2 weeks and put that result into the final report. So that'll be, we'll take some of these stress scenarios, the original 12, and we'll run them day-ahead market with MOC, without CME, and then we'll run them again on the same day-ahead market without MOC and with CME and kind of look at the difference in commitment and production cost if we can on those days.
So, Perry, for the parallel runs, I forgot how we set it up. You said we converted the MOCs to a CME-like constraint. So were the MOCs disabled in the parallel run?
Yeah, in the parallel environment, we had all of the MOCs disabled and we had all of the CME constraints.
Great.
Carrie
Bentley, WPTS. So I'm having a little hard time understanding the implication. If there were MOCs in the actual market, but then the CME didn't bind in parallel operations, does that indicate that the MOCs weren't in fact needed, or does that indicate that the CME constraint wasn't capturing the right, I don't know, needs?
It would indicate that once you actually model the constraint the right way, it would show that you, instead of using the MOC to do it, you would not have needed to commit some capacity that the MOC would have committed.
Which points to the benefit of CME, because you know the operators in advance aren't able to do all the calculations with the precision that the CME does, so they put the MOCs in. But if we have the CME in, they would not need to do the MOCs in advance because they could rely on the CME modeling.
Yeah, I took this note back to the operations engineers and I said, "What the heck? You don't need these MOCs." And they said, "No." They said, "Let me look at, Perry, let me put all of the information that I know when I run my study in front of you on the day that I run my study, and you'll make the same decision I make today, tomorrow, the next day. I'll put that MOC in." What CME does is you're now in the day-ahead market, and you have all of your up-to-date information of the day-ahead market. You have the CME constraint in there, and it may not be binding then. But you have all of your update information, and you're not guessing, what do I think hydro is going to be, what do I think load's going to be, and all of that other stuff.
With the pharmacy, I'm also confused by the conclusion or the expansion here. So the CME constraint did not bind, or bind rarely. But sometimes you said you still need a mark if you don't have semi constraints. I seem to not quite get at why that's the case. Because if you put semi constraints, the constraint did not bind, that means regardless if you have mark constraints or those units, the semi constraint does not make any difference in the market solution.
No, it does. It means that, you know, if you look at what happened and what will happen without CMEs, you're going to have a mock in the market if you don't have the CME constraint in there.
But
the mock will commit units. The CME may not commit the units that the mock committed, and you get this efficiency gain.
Well, and one clarification, when we say CME did not bind, that means it's not binding for energy dispatch. It doesn't mean that the way you're using it here, it doesn't mean that CME might not have committed a unit that wouldn't have been committed if the CME wasn't in, right?
Right.
So CME may change unit commitment, but not the, so the unit commitment may be changed with or without CME constraints. That's the.
Yeah, but I'm saying we're using the term CME, which means it wasn't binding in the energy dispatch, meaning we didn't have to dispatch any units up or down from where they otherwise would have been dispatched. But CME still might have committed, but because commitments are lumpy, then it relieves the CME constraint and it doesn't show up as binding.
When we're running it in parallel operations, that's just the energy market, right? So that means
right.
In the energy market, the unit commitment stayed the same, and it didn't bind in the energy market. So my interpretation is it's accurately modeling the constraints tells the operators that they don't need to make other commitments, whereas consistent with normal, if you can't accurately analyze the constraints, you've got to be conservative, and conservative means sometimes you're committing a unit when you don't need to.
Yeah, no, I guess you're right in the real-time parallel. I was thinking of the day ahead when we ran.
The parallel was day ahead market in parallel each day.
Oh, okay. So I thought this was okay. So when you don't in the parallel, was the unit commitment the same or different than in the real market?
We don't have that. We just know my screen disappeared. We didn't analyze the difference in the commitment pattern.
Okay.
We were looking to see if we were running. So the purpose of the parallel operations, say if we run this on actual market conditions day in, day out, how often will this constraint bind? Our purpose here was to inform what do we do with the congestion revenue rights portion of the policy. Because recall, what we're worried about when we look at the congestion revenue rights, potential enhancements to that market, we're worried how often is this thing going to be binding? Is there going to be a portion of the congestion component that's the CME portion? Are we going to need a new product in the CRR market so people can buy that congestion or not? So what this tells us is day in, day out, it's going to be rarely binding, and therefore we may not need to make huge changes to the CRR market. And I have that, I think, we're moving on to like my policy impact of results here. I essentially made all of these points, I think. So we had both the stress scenarios and we had the parallel operations show that the constraint rarely binds. Our market operations team prefers a sharper tool than the MOC, so they're telling us we would be comfortable using the CME rather than relying on the minimum online commitment. They have confidence that we can set up the constraints the appropriate way using CME. So what that tells us is we'll no longer need the MOCs that are associated with these constraints and any other similar constraints. We'll no longer need certain operating procedures that the operations engineer writes for the operations team. And CME ensures we have the effective capacity where we need it and when we need it. As we saw in the stress case, it got the corrective capacity when we need it, the San Diego binding case. It's in the market and results in better price formation here. Your point, though, Scott, is still valid on the, or Jim, rather, on did you look at MOC versus just you know, the MOC result versus CME result, what was the benefit if we look at that comparison, and we're working on that to get that into the final?
Yeah, I guess at this point we don't even know for sure that CME was more efficient.
Right.
Can't be.
If, well, I don't know.
Well, so yeah, the way that the CME definitions are, that's the limit. That's what, you know, if it determines we need capacity,
right.
We need
so
that.
So to the extent the CME is the definition of the optimum, then you can't do worse than that. That's what you're thinking.
It might not be any better.
Right? Might not be any better.
Carrie Bentley with WPTS. So you don't think it's de facto better if you didn't actually need the mock and the CME prevents it from putting in? I mean, in the scenario he described, it turned out that ISO didn't actually need to put those mocks in. So if you're doing a test case and comparing the mocks compared to CME, and you didn't need those mocks after all, de facto isn't CME.
Well, that was my thinking until this presentation, and apparently we don't know exactly how the commitment changed, though. So it could be that the mocks and CME resulted in the exact same commitment of units, in which case they got to the same place through different tools. But
I got lost during that part of the discussion because I thought Brad said the commitment changed, and then I thought Scott pointed out that the commitment did not change if it wasn't binding.
Same too. And now, like Jim, I understand. No, the commitment was changing. Actually, the constraint might have bound to the unit commitment and just wasn't binding in the energy dispatch. So we're in this situation where we're, you know, we thought we understood these results, and now I realize I don't. So.
But I don't think we know that it, we don't know either way whether the commitment changed or not, right?
We do know. So that San Diego binding case.
No, when the constraint did not bind.
Okay.
Yeah,
if
the constraint doesn't bind,
do we know
definitively one way or the other whether the commitment changed?
If the CME constraint is not binding? Yeah, it could come up with a different dispatch pattern than when you have the MOC. And remember, the MOC is a guess of saying, I think I'm going to need these units online. What CME might find if it's not binding is, I actually didn't need one of those units online in the first place.
Wait, you're now reversing yourself again because you just said that, you know, that it was just in the energy market and the unit commitment might have been different. So it might have relieved the constraint by committing other units so that it wasn't binding the energy market, but the commitment's different and we did take action so that it might have even had more energy inside the constraint than the mock, if it committed other units. I mean, that's what we're getting confused about the message here.
It's confusion over what binding and non-binding meant. I had interpreted non-binding to mean that it wasn't causing any actual changes, but apparently it could be causing changes to the commitment, and we're just sort of curious as to what those look like relative to what happened under the mock.
And I think we also need to clarify if you have a change, you need a baseline, and so that could be causing confusion too. So I understand if there was a mock and then you have the CME that doesn't allow mocks, the commitment is different. But on a day where you have no mocks and the CME doesn't bind, is there ever a case where the commitment will look different between situations?
Yeah, the answer to that one is no, it should not be different. If there was a day without the mock and I put the CME in, there shouldn't be a difference between those two because they've built this conservative mock around the expected condition for that day.
No, but Perry, if there, no, this is a day when there wasn't a mock, where they didn't force one, but they should have, in retrospect, CME
and
the units.
I see. So if an operations engineer missed a potential opportunity for, you know, they miscalculated and thought that they didn't need a mock, then, yeah, CME would get you the right capacity where you need it.
But then wouldn't it bind? That's the question. If it impacts commitments, does it always bind?
If it makes a commitment, it may not bind. When we say bind, it's when we're moving units out uneconomically relative to their energy bids. That I think we're using bind in too narrow of a a sense here. That's what we meant. But we meant when it's moving units up or down from their energy bids as defining as binding, that's separate from whether it may have bound in the commitment process and committed a unit, but then the lumpiness of the commitment relieves the constraint. So it doesn't.
We're committing a whole lot of excess capacity in the CME, and much more than we need, and that's why it's non-binding. We really need to understand more what's driving these numbers, I think.
So we were debating about Carrie's question, what she meant. So let me try with you. I
was really just trying to get you guys to go down this rabbit hole because
right.
I didn't think it was clear what the implications were, and everyone seemed to be breezing ahead. So don't unpack my specific statements too much. I just wanted you guys to like dig in more,
Great. Okay, fair enough. So I guess I interpreted your question as saying, let's say we just banned Box as a tool, and compare that to a world in which the CME is not binding for the same market conditions. Could anything be different? And my answer, and I thought the answer was yes, that CME might commit stuff, but then would not be binding under your definition of binding, and
right.
that would look different then. Okay. So. All right, so I guess the bottom line is we eagerly await the analysis that compares the two two approaches.
All right. So it's even just looking at whether the unit commitment is the same between the two cases and the same units are online would be answer a lot of it.
Yeah, it does impact the unit commitment, and you know the only result that I have right now is that I know for the San Diego day we had one less unit committed in the day-ahead market. Mock would have committed an additional unit, and CME did not, and CME went and got corrective capacity on another resource. So it saved on the commitment and gave some corrective capacity to a resource.
And to say it's non-binding in the energy market is also not the same thing as saying that it wouldn't affect prices, just that it wouldn't affect the CRR specific issue.
Yeah, and on this, the purpose of the parallel ops to see how much would it affect the congestion, therefore how worried do we need to be in this for the CRR market changes.
So it might affect congestion in some ways, but in a way that's still captured in the traditional CRR instrument.
Right. Looks like Wei has a question or comment.
Just a quick clarification question, Wei from AC. I thought that the first bullet conveyed a different message or what I was expecting. So the operation engineers would prefer CME than the MOC because if we say the sharper tool to me, because CME, if it's enforcing the day ahead, you have to involve the virtual bids, you know, this flow, commercial flow, not physical flow. The MOC constraint give you more of a commitment of a resource more from physical perspective to address the physical problem. So from that perspective, it seems to me the MOC constraint will be a sharper tool than CME for if you are really concerned about reliability. So I just got couldn't read the first bullet right there.
No, that's not what we're saying. The MOC, as you back further away from that day-ahead market, you have more and more imperfect data. So what we mean by sharper here is you actually define the exact constraint. With the mock, the operations engineer already knows the exact constraint, and then they go and they guess, what's hydro going to look like that day? What's load going to look like that day, in my pocket, out of my pocket? What do I think, based on what happened last year, generation is going to be? And then they're using all of these assumptions within their study, and they're defining an MOC to try to solve their problem. What they're saying as a sharper tool here is, I'll just put that constraint that I already know what it is, right into the market and it solves it. Okay. And then I don't need any of my stale data by the time I get to the day ahead market.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, and we have another, so that was, we kind of went through your thoughts. Here we could, nothing on the phone. We do have another uninteresting result, which, for you guys, and that's, well, yeah, okay, you might find something interesting about this. So at the February MSC meeting, recall the San Diego case was able to clear less load. Interesting to note on that case, we saw the CME commit or clear load that was much closer to our day ahead forecasted load. Whereas if you go for the all what happened in the day ahead market without CME, it clears something like 200, 250 more megawatts of load on that day. So what we did is we said there's two ways to go about this. We could try to manufacture a case, like take that same day ahead market and freeze load in there and say, okay, assume you can't clear less load, what would my prices be? And that would be like a manufactured, not real sort of scenario. The other way to go about doing this, which is the way that we chose because we wanted to try to stick with real life scenario, is to go on that same day and drill down into those peak hours that were binding in the day ahead market for that day and run it in the real time market with CME for those intervals. So we ran 12 intervals across 3 hours on that peak day. And CME did not bind in those hours. So, you know, by running it in real-time market, there's, you know, the model can't clear less demand than actual forecasted demand for that 15-minute interval, and it did not bind. There was enough capacity to solve the problem that it was put in there to solve. Potentially uninteresting result.
When you reran this, you reduced the load when you reran it in real-time and it didn't bind? Or you kept the original load?
We kept the load from that interval, whatever that was, the forecast load for that interval, ran that exact real-time interval.
Then why did it not clear in the day-ahead market if the constraint wasn't binding?
So we literally got this result like Friday afternoon.
Okay.
We're still digging into that. We have a couple theories. It could be that you actually needed less load by the time that you got there, or needed about the load that you cleared in the day ahead. Remember, the day ahead you might have some impact from virtual demand that perhaps you never needed to clear for anyway. Another thought might be that maybe the unit commitment happened to be different by the time that we got to that hour in the day, and all of a sudden you had enough capacity on
computer. Okay, well, it seems like we need to understand those before we can really interpret it. So we'll look forward. I guess it'll be covered in the report.
Yep.
Just to refresh my memory, so this was the one case where it was binding in the day ahead, and the results were that I remember this then that there was a curtailment of day ahead load as part of the solution using CME.
Right.
Right. And
so then we drilled into those hours specifically in the real-time market and ran that. So we can put a little bit more flavor on that one in the report, but like I said, it's, you know, Friday afternoon. It was, you know, the team did a really good job at getting that together very, very quickly too, so. Okay, I think we can, if you guys have any thoughts on any of this, what, like I said, as it relates to, you know, seeing that it's not binding, and binding in the sense here of impacting the congestion, or, you know, pricing from a CRR standpoint, it's looking like we would need to make minimal changes to the congestion revenue rights market for these, and then monitor it going forward.
Wei, do you have a question?
Just a quick comment. I think when you said it's really a binding, it like indicates that you kind of think the impact of CR market may be less severe than you originally expected. My comment probably is that if you look at the CR revenue shortfall or the efficient, I mean the revenue sufficiency issue, it doesn't necessarily rely on the frequency of the binding constraints. It's probably more on 1 or 2 days you really get a bad situation when the constraint, you know, really bind with a very high shadow price. That the case may be more concerned about.
Yeah, so and we'll put this into the draft final proposal when we release it. What we would look to doing is either, actually what we're looking at doing is not settling the congestion component as it relates to the preventive corrective contingency for anyone that purchases the that CRR. So that would be the minimal change. Therefore, I'm not paying anyone for that congestion component anyway. So that's the conservative approach.
But you also have a counterflow SCR. So if you don't pay for the prevailing CRs, you indicate that means you will pay counterflow CRs. I probably need to give details of the proposal, but
yep, thanks. I have someone on the phone. Is the question for me or for the MSC?
Operator, is there a question?
This is Seth Cochran with DC Energy. So actually, my question's for Perry. I was just looking through the old CR alternatives paper, and are you saying that you're contemplating going forward with option 1A, no change?
No, I think it was. Remind me, is there's the no impact? Is there's 3.D? I believe would be the one that we'd go for. So the
3.D.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not the Cadillac option, though, right?
No. That's the point here. Is we don't need a Cadillac.
Okay. All right, I'll look through the paper. Maybe I'll touch base with you offline. I have that as single bid for allocation.
Okay. Oh, okay.
All right.
Yeah, that's it on the CME results. And thanks for some further suggestions to add some flavor to the final report on that.
Okay. So this is going to the board in September. So we'll be preparing an opinion on this and make your presentation responsiveness to all the questions. Any further comments here or on the line? Any further questions? If not, thanks for getting us back on schedule, in fact, a little bit ahead. I'm sure the next speaker will appreciate that, who happens to be you.
Well, don't thank me yet. Let's see. Hopefully we can keep this one on schedule, too. Okay, so we have generator contingency remedial action scheme modeling. On Friday, June 30th, we put out our draft final proposal on this. And in that proposal, there were a few changes from the previous proposal. And you know, and I'm going to focus on the big changes here, or what I guess I consider the big changes. The first big change was to extend the remedial action scheme contingency model to model remedial action schemes that also drop load or reconfigure the transmission system. Another change we made is to just expand on our discussion about the impact of virtual supply and demand on the remedial action scheme constraint. And we made our final proposal on the congestion revenue rights market basically going forward, fully modeling this constraint in the CRR market. But what we changed was our calculation of how we're calculating that generation distribution factor for purposes of running the CRR market. Okay, so the first item was modeling remedial action schemes that drop load or reconfigure the transmission system. This change actually fits in quite nice in this initiative, and it adds a lot of value. There's a lot of these types of contingencies. There's actually more of these types of contingencies than the kind that just drop generation. So this is an excellent suggestion, I think, by PG&E. So how would this work? Well, if a remedial action scheme is programmed to drop load, then this load drop will be modeled with the contingency. What that means is that you're spreading a different megawatt quantity around to all of the nodes on the system to model that pickup effect, and that pickup affects the impact on all transmission constraints. So an example of this would be if a remedial action scheme is programmed, you lose 1,000 megawatts of generation and 500 megawatts of load. That results in modeling the pickup effect as a net of the two 500 megawatts of generation on the transmission system. This is how the generation on the system will respond to the event immediately after the event. On the other side of it, you could see a loss of 1,000 megawatts of load and 500 megawatts of generation, and this would result in modeling the pickup effect of 500 megawatts of load spread around the system and what that does to constraints. So this is so there were two kind of parts to this extension of the model. The first is this generation drop and load drop. The second is, or it's a load drop in the system reconfiguration. Second part, reconfiguration, where the remedial action scheme is programmed to reconfigure the transmission system, if it's switching lines in and out. So if you lose a line, it's going to switch two other lines in, or you know, any other crazy thing happens. We would model that, and it fits in nice because all it does is change the shift factors in case. So we would use the post-contingency shift factors of whatever that post-contingency system looks like with the line out and the new lines in, or with you know whatever lines are out after the remedial action scheme contingency.
So this is a question the stakeholder brought up that asking about the modeling of load. I was thinking about this. It seems to me that, you know, analogous to the generator, since this load would be dropped in the contingency, it shouldn't pay that part of the price at its location. So the price to the load that's getting dropped would be you'd set the shadow price of that constraint to zero so that this 500 megawatts should get a lower load price. That wasn't covered in the right over afterwards in the paper, and it wasn't covered, but I think that is that what you envision, or
yeah, because you'd have a basically this generator flow factor using that just generation distribution factor, the impact. So it would be charged for the congestion, for any of the congestion that contingency causes on the system, and that might come out to be nothing, and therefore there'll be a higher that node. So what this means is there's two types here. There's just the regular load type. And that means that it'll impact that raw LMP, nodal LMP price there, and then that'll be rolled up into the DLAP like today. The other piece of it is for like pumping load and whatnot. That'll just impact the pumping load's price. Okay, so in response to the revised straw proposal, SCE said that we would benefit from a discussion on the impact of virtuals on RAS or gen contingency events. So we've added, I guess, some more flavor to that discussion. And in this slide deck, I'll just do a really quick example for you guys. We clarify here, virtual supply at a generator contingency node will be treated the same as physical supply. This is consistent with how we treat virtuals today. We would enforce the contingency constraint regardless of the amount of supply bid in at the location. I think there was this thought that for somehow the amount, if I'm not bidding anything in at a node, I would not be enforcing the contingency. That's not what we want to do. You enforce the contingency regardless of the amount of supply or demand bid in at the location. And all it means is if you have 0 megawatts of virtual or physical supply bids at that node, that just means you're spreading 0 megawatts around the system to model that pickup effect. In the day-ahead market, generator contingency node will be charged for the congestion it causes. That would apply to both the virtual and the physical. So if I'm dropping a generator and it causes some congestion somewhere on the system, then the virtual is going to be charged for that congestion also. So it's consistent. So this all works out nice as long as the constraints modeled and enforced in both the day-ahead and the real-time market. We discussed at the May MSC meeting this potential undesirable situation that could occur if we don't model and enforce it in both of these markets. So our proposal is, you know, you model it consistent in both. Now, as for an example, I wanted to try to keep it easy. So this was the same example that we talked through at the MSC meeting in May. But here I've just added, and I don't know if I have a laser pointer on this thing. No. Ah, look at that. Okay. So I've split my A1 node into like virtuals bidding in at A1 and physicals bidding in at A1. Recall that the contingency is loss of G1 and T2 at the same time. So here I have them bidding in. I'll say, okay, well, I'm not going to bid any physical into the day-ahead market, but some virtual is going to bid in at $30. You can see when you enforce the constraint, both markets, or at least in the day-ahead market here, you get a generator flow factor, so there is some impact on the constraint, and they end up with an LMP of $49.62. So the virtual is going to get paid $49.62, and they get an award of 200 megawatts here. I kept this simple. I said the virtual bids in 200 megawatts because that's the amount of physical generation that's at A1. And then what you see is if you enforce the same constraint in the real-time market, it is the same constraint that's binding here for a flow of 750 megawatts on the line. This is in the bottom table. And you still have that generator flow factor from node A1 to the constraint. The LMP comes out to be the same because you have a shadow cost of $15 here. So the LMP is $49.62. Their award is now, they're liquidated in the real-time market, so now they have to buy back 200 at the same price, and it works. This is what we, super similar to what we were walking through in the May meeting where we were talked about what could happen if you don't actually model this in the real-time market. Your LMP would go to $35, and then I have someone only needing to pay back $35.
So, Perry, I noticed the real-time award of G2 is 750 megawatts up from 744, because in real-time you'd adjust where the generation pickup was going to be based on the difference between the day-ahead unit commitment and the real-time, so that since the virtual disappeared and there's no generation, is that what's causing the difference, or is it something else?
Yeah, you're right that could cause a difference. In this example, it's not, though. The difference here is in neither the day-ahead market nor the real-time market, the physical's not bidding in it into either market.
Right. But the virtual's in the...
The virtual's in the day-ahead, right?
Right, so...
So what happened is the only other generators that I could get energy on in the real-time market were G2 and G3,
mm-hmm.
And it happens to be that because the contingency is G1, loss of G1, your GDF stays the same, and it's based on the ratio of G2's ratio on the total system, G3's ratio on the total system, and then the system ratio on the total system. So this is really simply just clearing 1,500 megawatts for 1,500 megawatts of load, and the only place it can get it in the real-time market is G2 and G3. So that's why I can only use 750 megawatts of G2 before my constraint of 750 megawatts binds to serve this load.
But if there were 200 megawatts of physical in the day-ahead market, well, why?
Yeah. So you're right. If there were 200 megawatts of physical, no, there were not 200 megawatts of physical bidding into the day-ahead market.
Right. There's just virtual. So you're basically the contingency is you're treating the virtual as the contingency. So there's a contingency of the loss of T2 and dropping 200 megawatts of load. Is that 200 megawatts of generation?
Yep.
Right. Okay. And then in real time, there's no generation. G1. Yeah, there's no G1, so that's why.
Is that what you're assuming, that G1 goes away? They're not available?
I'm just saying, okay, G1 doesn't bid in. It doesn't participate in day-ahead. G1 doesn't participate in real time. That's what I've assumed in this example.
In the second part.
So you could have, you could have G1.
If the contingency is G1 in the day-ahead market, then there shouldn't be any flow from G1 either. So why isn't G2 750?
The contingency here is this A1 node. So any physical generation injecting at A1 or any virtual injecting at A1, that's the contingency. So that's why you have a shift factor to this constraint, and these shift factors are exactly the same.
Why is the day-ahead schedule for G2 744.97 instead of 500? Roger, do you know the answer?
Yeah, I
have more questions.
When you lose,
I think I'm missing some.
I understand. When you lose the node A1, all generation, virtual or physical, they assume that it's being picked up in a kind of like a response by all the other units.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that's going to be picked up by G2. So you've got to reserve space on the line in the contingency case for the fact that G2 is going to increase a little bit. And that reserve space is being charged to the virtual, which is why his LMP is not 50. But in real time, when you lose A1, there's no loss of anything, so you don't have to reserve any space. So G2 can go up to 750.
The result would be 744.97 in real-time market if I had that physical bid in 200 megawatts in the real-time market. Because then I need to reserve the extra 5 megawatts and change on the transmission line for the pickup effect.
But suppose somebody put in a virtual demand bid at A1.
You're going to have to help me walk through that example.
What?
So you're saying suppose someone...
I was just wondering how it was going to work. Suppose they put in a 50 megawatt virtual demand bid, and suppose there was physical generation. Would that reduce the amount of physical generation? Would that, in the contingency, I guess you'd be losing the load too? Is that what you'd be modeling?
Right, and anything bid in at A1, it will take the injection or withdrawal, the net injection or withdrawal at A1 is the generation that needs to be spread to the system, or load that needs to be spread to the system.
So there was 200 megawatts of virtual demand. You could have actually inked G2 in the day and market above 750 because that virtual demand would have been providing counterflow, basically.
Okay. So, and I think this is a really good example to walk through some of these things. So. If you have any more ideas for this, then we could try to run those to ground also. Just let me know. Steve, you have a question?
That's my fault.
I'm just wondering, in this case, there's no generator contingency on G3?
No, yeah, you're right. We're not enforcing just a plain vanilla gen contingency on G3. The only constraint, the only constraints that we've enforced here is your power balance, your loss of G1 and T2 at the same time, and your normal rating of 1,000 megawatts on the transmission, just those three constraints. Okay. So as far as the CRR market goes, we've maintained our proposal to directly model the constraints in the CRR market. This was something that we included in the revised straw proposal. However, we did update the methodology we'll use to calculate the generation distribution factors for the CRR market. This was suggested by PG&E, and we adopted this methodology in the proposal. So recall that the generation distribution factor impacts where the system picks up the lost generation. The reason this methodology is important is because there's an inherent granularity difference between the CRR market and the day-ahead market. That's the CRR market has 2 time of uses per month, and the day-ahead market has 744 hours in the month. The CRR market can only model one GDF, one generation distribution factor, per time of use per month. That's per resource, per contingency. But in the day-ahead market, we'll have different GDFs per hour, per resource, per contingency. So there's a potential here for a revenue imbalance if we don't get an accurate GDF to model in the CRR market. So we're proposing to use a monthly average GDF per resource per contingency. It looks like this, but the main point is that it's a monthly average of the committed capacity of the resource. Remember, previously we proposed to base this on a monthly production information. PG&E suggests that we base on an average ratio of committed capacity, similar to what we would actually experience in the day-ahead market. So you can see we're doing this over, if H is your set of hours in the season, we're in the time period of interest, that means we're doing it for peak period. So you're going to end up with a peak GDF per resource per RAS contingency. And then you'll have an off-peak one, and you're using the number of hours in the peak period or non-peak hour or non-peak period.
Is this coming off of historical commitment data then?
Yeah, this is not. The first time we ran the numbers, we used that month, and we're like, oh, this is great. It's very accurate. And then we stepped back and said, you can't use this month's data to produce this month's GDS. So you have to go back to the previous year's data to calculate the GDF that you're going to use in this month's auction. So PG&E did suggest that we figure out how accurate it is when you use last year's information to calculate the GDF that you are going to use in the CRR market this year, and then compare that to what's the GDFs you actually experience in the day-ahead market. So we analyzed from January 2016 through January 2017, calculated our monthly CRR GDFs for 2016 based on the 2015 data, and we calculated our actual 2016 GDFs per hour, so we had 744 of those per month per resource. And then, so in that data, we find that almost 95% of the day-ahead market hours had GDFs within 0.005 of what we would have modeled in the CRR market.
You're saying each and every one of the GDFs were within this, or, okay.
Yeah, no. We model one GDF, you know, per resource, right? And for that resource, it has this one GDF, and you have to compare that to 744 different GDFs that you actually experience in the day-ahead market. And we're saying that one that we modeled was within 0.005 of the actual that we experienced in the day-ahead market 95% of the time.
Okay.
These are the generation pickup GDFs. What is the magnitude of them, though? I mean, I don't know whether that means that they're
10%.
80% of the actual value or 2%, because wouldn't those be, it seems like the pickup would be rather small, so that I don't know.
Yeah, so the pickup values are small themselves, and then what we're saying here is that you're within half a percent of that small value. So the actual pickup values range anywhere from 0 to 5%.
So is this a within 0.005% of the occupancy?
No, this is 0.005. So we wanted to talk about GDS in terms of the GDS value itself was within 0.005. So we're
So
that's 10%?
If the GDF was 5% in the day ahead market, the GDF, if the GDF we modeled in the CRR market was 5%, let's say, that means that the actual experienced GDF in the day ahead market was between 4.5 and 5.5.
Right.
Yeah, so it was off by 10%, 5% of the time.
Yeah, but suppose it was 0.001 in the day-ahead market, then it was off by 50%, right? So I mean, don't we need to know what the average value is?
In other words, you may want to think about reporting this in terms of a percentage of the actual GDF, the percent error, rather than as an absolute number. Because if these small deviations are actually experienced on very small shift factors, then they could be much more consequential than what it looks like here.
So we took a different, that's probably something good to look at. We took a different tack and we jumped straight to impact on revenue imbalance. We used our actual day-ahead market shift factors to binding constraints. And this data, and we calculate, so now you're bringing the shift factor into it, saying this difference in the GDF would have accounted for an additional $200,000 in deficit over the year. I'll say year, but it was actually a 13-month period because it was through the end of January 2017. So we see some of these differences actually add money to the balancing account, and some of these differences take money away from the balancing account, and at the end of the year, you have this $200,000 deficit caused by the differences in these two GDS. So we saw this and we're thinking, you know, small numbers here.
And
I'm
just going to ask, compare that to the magnitude of the overall revenue inadequacy of the CRR system.
On a
one-year basis,
are we 100 million? What is it? No, 25 million a quarter or something?
This is a very small number.
This is a very small number.
So this is the you had another number in the paper, which was that the actual impact was 44,000 the other way because of when you looked at the actual outages. I was confused about what was being calculated here as opposed to in the other calculation.
The other calculation from the previous paper with the $45,000 surplus was real-time congestion imbalance offset. That's when you go from day ahead into real time. What's the difference in those GDFs cause? This, what we did here is we went from CRR market to day ahead market, and there's a difference in GDF. What kind of imbalance would that cause? So in the real-time congestion imbalance offset, we saw a surplus. Here we're seeing the deficit, 200,000.
Okay.
And I'll look back at the data to see how easy it would be to describe percentage error.
So you ran a year of day-ahead markets with the RAS and schemes in and...
No. So this is, again, we use the binding constraints. I mean, we couldn't run a year of the market.
Right, that's why
and we don't have all of the data. All we have is the binding constraints, the shadow costs, shift factors for all those, for all the nodes to those binding constraints.
Okay, but you weren't modeling the RAS schemes in the day-ahead market.
No.
So what...
So you take the GDF from the CRR market minus the GDF experienced in that hour in the day-ahead market, you multiply that by the shift factor, multiplied by the shadow price, multiplied by the megawatts of generation in that hour that you would have had to have spread around the system to all of the constraints, and then you end up with either the deficit or surplus.
These are the post-contingency loss of generation and transmission shift factor, system pickup shift factors?
What we did here was we used the generation, the loss of, you know, if I lose 2,000 megawatts of generation, I know that, that's part of, that's the contingency, I have that resource, and if I know that those set of resources in the RAS, I can then figure out the rest of the system GDFs. And I know the rest of the system's shift factors to all of the binding constraints, and I can multiply those. I'm now spreading a megawatt quantity around the system, and I know how much more or less emission I would have needed to have reserved to spread 2,000 megawatts around the system.
Where are the prices coming from?
Whatever the binding constraint was that we experienced in the day-ahead market. So we have, for the binding constraint, we have a shadow cost.
In the actual run market. That did not include the RAS.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah, this is again here it's an estimate of potential revenue imbalance. You know, if these numbers were starting to blow up, we would maybe consider digging into, you know, trying to get a better picture. But we hit this with fairly large RASs and looked at it. And
what would this look like without the averaging methodology, if you use just the simple number?
Without averaging what?
Without doing the hour-by-hour differentiation.
This was originally motivated
by sort of the PG&E suggestion to do that, the kind of higher time resolution.
Oh, yeah. You're saying if we compared it to what we previously...
Yeah, compared to the simpler approach that you had originally proposed.
Oh, we didn't do that comparison. We figured, hey, you know...
This is better, so...
Yeah, you gotta, the point of an average is to get your minimum distance between all points on the line, so figured that was... We couldn't see the trees through the forest on that one when we did the revised straw proposal. Steve, do you have a question?
Yeah, and calculating that average is, I'm trying to understand exactly like how the RASs are, how they're armed and how they interact with the way the market works. So when these units were committed, were they always subject to the RAS?
In today's market?
Well, you said you went back and you took an average of the hours when the units were committed.
Yep.
Yeah, so does that mean that whenever they're committed, they're subject to the RAS?
Yeah, so what we did is you mean if I have some generator that's part of some RAS scheme and it's dispatched to 500 megawatts, does that mean I'm going to need to drop?
Does that mean it's subject to 500 megawatt RAS? And if it's committed to only 200 megawatts, is it subject to a 200 megawatt RAS?
Yeah, so that's what we did. We used the actual commitment from the actual hour. If it was committed to 500, we spread 500. If it was committed only 200, we spread 200 around the system.
My question is different, though. My question is, when these units are committed in the real world, are they always subject to that RAS? Is the RAS always armed on them?
Yeah, so for the ones we looked at, if the RAS is enabled on it,
yeah.
What we would do in the day-ahead market, so this is more of what's in the paper on how we plan to enforce these in the paper. We would dispatch up into that, if it actually is the cheapest generation, we would dispatch the resource up into that zone to which it would be armed at that point. I think we talked about this at the last meeting.
Okay.
So. But we can talk.
So these GDFs are the actual GDFs that were used in the day-ahead market to model the pickup. We didn't have the RAS pricing, but we had the actual
commitment pattern.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was a complicated and fun analysis to do. Okay. So we've proposed in the paper that we released on June 30th to model the remedial action schemes that are programmed to drop load or reconfigure the transmission system. We're going to treat virtual supply and demand the same as physical supply and demand, and we are proposing to utilize this monthly average generation distribution factor in the CRR market. What our point on the CRR market one is it seems accurate and it seems like it results in not too much deficiency, at least looking at the year of data that we looked at. It wasn't raising any eyebrows.
So I guess the only, you know, additional concern would be if the changes in prices experienced by imposing the RAS scheme are highly correlated with periods where you have a big difference between these two measurements, then the number could get bigger. I don't know how much bigger, but
that's a good point.
And I forget how, I don't know, do you have any sense of what the price impact sort of balance might be?
Yeah,
because it's just been test cases.
Yep. Seems like I've bored everyone to sleep. Oh, no, Wei. Wei's got it. But we don't have to use all the remaining 2 hours to grill me on this. No pressure there.
Okay, this is Weta from SC. Can we go back to slide 7? I want to go back to the virtual bidding example that we didn't talk through. I want to make sure I understand the example. So if G1 is bidding at 200 virtual demand, 200 megawatts virtual demand, right? So I think you could increase G3 by 200 megawatts, not G2, because G2 is binding at 750 or 744.97 megawatts in this example, right?
You're in the day-ahead market table?
Day-ahead market.
Okay, you're saying instead of the virtual bidding 200 megawatts, you have the physical bid 200 megawatts?
No, it's instead of the virtual supply, you've got a virtual demand at the G1.
Okay, you're going to make me think on my feet on this, but let's between the two of us, let's figure it out.
Okay, so my math is here. So G2 cannot be dispatched higher than 750.
It can't be dispatched technically higher than 800, that's the Pmax. So if you had more load at, if you said demand, right, virtual demand at A1, then all that means is you're able to flow to whatever this is, 5.03 megawatts. You would allow an extra 5.3 megawatts flowing over on T1 from A to B.
I'm not looking at a decimal point at this moment. I can only do the math by integration.
Well, let's say 5 megawatts, yeah.
So if you have 200 megawatts of virtual demand, because G2 cannot be dispatched up or exceeding 750 megawatts, the reason being if you take T2 out, then G1 also be out. You only have 750 left. So regardless of what your virtual bidding is at the G1, G2 cannot be dispatched more than 750 megawatts. I know you have some spreading effect.
That's what's due to the pickup effect, right? The spreading of the load to.
Right. So that may be 5 megawatts, depending.
Sure.
But yeah, ignoring that, the G2 cannot be dispatched more than 750 plus or minus 5 megawatts.
Well, I mean, in this contingency, I'd say it could be dispatched to 755 or whatever. What's going to happen is when you get to the real-time market, that's where you're going to see that demand, that virtual demand no longer there, and this is going to bind at the 750, so your transmission's secure.
The reason I'm asking this question is to see if we have any uplift issue. Because to me, if you have a virtual demand of G1 of 200 megawatts, and in this example, the only increase in the dispatch you would have is on G3. So because G2 cannot be more than 750 megawatts or plus or minus 5 megawatts.
I think he's right. So if you put in a virtual demand bid at G1, it'd have to be met with the expensive generation at G3. So you'd be buying at $50 or maybe even more than $50, say $75 in the day-ahead market. Then we get into, and you know, the constraint would be, you know, you'd have G2 operating at around 750, as you said. But 200 of that would be in the day ahead would be going to meet G1, but the constraint would still be binding because the post contingency flows would be 750, as you said. Then we get into real time, and now we wouldn't have that load at G1. We'd still have G2 at around 750, and G3 would be dispatched down 200 megawatts. So you would have bought day ahead at $75, and then at real time you'd be selling it back at 50. So I mean, it seems like, yeah, the virtual bidder could lose money if it wanted to, but it works.
Yeah, I think probably the uplift-wise probably be okay. But if we just look at this example, though, there is uplift issue, but probably to a decimal point. I think that's probably just the way the math works, not a issue that we should be concerned about. Because you got a 744 megawatts, 0.97 megawatts, so that's $35, and then you move it real time, it's 750. So there's still some uplift dollars, but it's probably just how the math works is we shouldn't be worried about.
I'm sure it's uplift. It might be congestion rent. I thought the way I did it, it was we're picking up a little bit of extra congestion rents in there, not uplift, but we're paying people a little less. You know, we're paying $49.62 rather than $50.
Yeah, the congestion should be covered in this. That's, I think, explicit in the formulation. Like Scott said, you see it here with the, you're at $49.62, I've charged this guy 38 cents of congestion. I think the same kind of thing happens once you introduce a virtual demand. I'm not saying it would be a winning strategy, but I think from a, you know, congestion standpoint, you're covered here. Unless I'm missing something.
This is Steve. The way this example works, I mean, the other way that I went through and calculated it out is when you go from day ahead to real time, if you look at replacing the energy, okay, what you have to do is, you know, when you look at that, basically you can get 5.03 megawatts additional energy from G2. So you pay 35 for that, and then you have to buy the remainder $244.93 or whatever from G3 at $50. So that ends up, when you average that out, you get to the $49.62. So you get exactly that same price. There's some interesting questions that I see, like with a virtual demand bid there, how that's going to affect the price. Because I think you're right. I think what would happen is you would be able to take the generation from G2, you'd be able to have 755.03 because that 200 of demand that's there would be armed. So when you lost one of the transmission lines, you'd also lose that 200 of demand, which would be spread to everybody. So that means G2 would be assumed to lose its share of that, which would be the 5.03. So that would drop down so that in that case it would be right at 750. No, but the assumption that Perry's making is that all virtual at a particular, like a generation node, is assumed to be on a RAS. Whether it's... Right. But no, but I'm not saying, but what happens at G2 is when the RAS operates at G1 and you lose the 200 megawatts of virtual load that's there, okay, that means every generator on the system has to reduce its output so that you're 200 less in output. G2 gets its share of that reduction in output. That reduction in output is just the 5.03. So it's actually, you know, it's set to generate 700 and, or what is it, 755.03. When the RAS operates and it loses its share, so like if that line goes out and the RAS takes the demand off, it drops to 750, so it's, you're fine. You're not overloading the line. But I'm not quick enough to figure out what that's going to do to the price at that, at the G1 node that demand is going to pay.
Pre and post contingency. I mean, it's binding in the day ahead market and the real time in that contingency. So the price is at.
I mean, we know a generation. You know, the generation price was a little bit lower because it was dealing with the congestion, relieving some of the congestion by having the RAS. I can't think through fast enough which way the price would affect.
The difference we've been talking about is between day ahead and real time. In a real time, there'll be 200 megawatts less load. So it's not just a matter of the 5 megawatts that gets lost.
Yeah,
in the contingency we were talking about between the
in the real time.
Yeah,
that will drop. It'll be 750. Right.
Well, it's not just 750. It's at G3. There'll be 200 megawatts less load. So
yeah.
Overall, so it's G3 that's setting the price, and G3 will be way lower. So it might be down to $50 again, whereas it was $75 day ahead. And it'll be a little difference for the generation drop, but the big thing is the big slug of difference in load that's cleared day ahead between real time. If we have a bunch of virtual, just like any other virtual demand, if you bid a bunch of virtual demand in and it's not proxying for anything and there's just less load in real time, then the real time price will be lower.
I had another question on this. If there were two generators at node one and only one of them had a RAS scheme,
we would see that as A1, A2, and A3 nodes. You'd have to, it gets its own pricing
node. It gets its own node. Okay, so because I was just wondering, you're sort of automatically assuming that the virtual is being picked up by the generator with the RAS scheme and not something else. It seems in the way this is
played. Well, it gets dropped with the RAS scheme, and picked up by the rest of the generation on the system, the frequency response capable generation on the system.
Well, but implicitly, since this is virtual supply, right? That you're just underneath all of this is the assumption that it's actually G1 that's going to be on. For the contingency to even be relevant.
Yeah, sure. So the I'm not going to make some random, you know, A6 node just for virtual to play at, right? It's going to be, this is an actual RAS contingency at an actual RAS node in the system, and that's the way that'll be modeled.
Okay, but then, yeah, so every contingency is generator specific, so there wouldn't be a circumstance.
There's going to be a
generator.
Out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I look at it is, if for some reason the resource at G1 were, say, it was some intermittent that didn't bid into the market because its contract didn't need to, and it were
the entity that the virtual bidder was actually the load serving entity that contracted with it, and it wanted to bid in because the stupid generator didn't have incentive to, then, you know, we'd just be saying, okay, the supply is really going to be there in real time because the wind generator is really going to blow. It's just that generator isn't bidding in, and someone else is basically proxying for them. So if they were really proxying for them, it would make the day-ahead market more like real time. But if there actually was going to be no generation there at G1, then it would be unprofitable because they're not proxying for anything.
I have something you said, Jim, raises a question for me. This is Steve Keene from Navigant again. G1 and G2 are essentially at the same node, but we're assigning them different nodes because one of them is subject to a RAS. Well, with virtual bidding, if I can put a virtual load bid in, what happens if I put it in at G1, it's the load bid is subject to the RAS and then different things happen. What if I put the load bid in at G2 where it's not subject to the RAS? Then what happens? And
it'll have a, if it's at G1, it'll have a shift factor to the constraint of 1 rather than the 0.025 or
G2 to get a schedule up to, you know, around 950 because there'd be 200 megawatts of load, and then in real time it'd have to be dispatched way down, so you'd be buying high and selling cheap. So I think it should work right.
We could spend more time staring at this and playing with the numbers, but I think that the point that we wanted to get across is this is a transmission constraint. GCARM's it's a transmission constraint that we put in the market. Virtuals compete on work on the existing transmission constraints today. This is a transmission constraint. So, you know, at the face of it, we didn't see an issue with extending it and allowing the virtuals to participate the same as they participate today, just at these nodes. Way, you want to keep us going?
Just a quick comment, though. I thought the exam would be very simple because I only had three nodes, or actually two nodes, three units, but it's more than I can think at this moment. So just a quick comment. Would you be able to consider to have some market simulation, kind of, you know, do more analysis, run on the realistic case to see what real benefit you can get from by adopting this proposal, because I think there are a lot of complexities if you put this in the market, and also ASE has a concern how it's going to interact on the interconnection process from the price-wise or reward-wise. We put that in our comments. So we are concerned on that. So we wanted to know how much incremental benefits you can get by putting into the market, and then we can talk about, you know, the benefit versus the cost or the risk. So I'm not sure if we can consider that, so we can kind of quantify that. Because there's some cost. You're going to have to develop a new system. You have to make changes to CR markets, and it's not clear what incremental benefit can get from this proposal. Just a thought.
Well, to even do market simulation, we'd have to build out the all-out functionality and spend the money on building it anyway. You know, so we would incur that same cost that we would incur to just build it and go live with it. Now, we do market sim prior to releasing, you know, in the production and the map stage environments for stakeholders, market participants to play with prior to go live. I mean, that's existing, you know, process that'll continue. I don't foresee us going out building an all-out model on this and trying to come up with the exact anticipated benefit here. From our standpoint, it takes no longer than 5 minutes of sitting with an operator to realize there's a ton of this stuff out there on the system that they're managing out of market today. It's anecdotal, but it's saying you're doing a whole bunch of stuff. We have whole procedures written. The whole purpose of those procedures are to take out of market action. So there's going to be some efficiency gain and some benefit by getting these into the market.
Benefit because the operators have to spend a lot of their time tracking this crap, and as we're trying to manage, you know, more and more intermittence on the system, you know, we have less and less time to manage this, and we have more and more real reliability issues that they need to deal with. So this frees up operator time to do the other things they need to do as we raise the level of, you know, intermittent resources on the system. So you can look at it as a very difficult to do just a dollar efficiency cost benefit, but more what else would we have to do to operate the system reliably if the operators are have to continue to manage this in an ad hoc manner?
Well, I think that it's not the case that we don't model this ad hoc schemes in the market today. I think probably just more for like using the normal grants, more of a simplified approach. It's not the case that we don't consider the RAS in market solution at all today. So I think the status quo is kind of the reference level, what incremental benefit can get more than you can get from today. I think my understanding today that you do consider the RAS schemes for rapid purposes when you have the market solution, but that's not optimal solution, you know, Perry wants to be, but or ISO wants to be, but I think you do have some methodology today to address that in the market.
Understanding is they had ad hoc tools to manage these RAS, and that's exactly the situation where it takes up a lot of operator attention to do the ad hoc as opposed to having it automated, just like ad hoc managing other transmission constraints.
Yeah, I see. Fully agrees that if this can be automated, it's a great idea to, you know, the motivation is right. But we are concerned, we're not certain what signal is going to send to the interconnection process, what impacts there, you know, as we let out in our comments.
Anyone else? Okay, everyone gets a happy hour early then.
Does set a record. If that's the case, we have nothing online. No further comments here. This will also be going to the September board. It will be writing an opinion and be having, as usual, a public call or a public meeting. Okay, so that concludes this item. Then all we have left is a future agenda items, and I see nobody leaping out of their chair to offer some of those. We are tentatively scheduled to have our next meeting in the MSC at the beginning of September, which may or may not be when we vote on the two opinions that we'll be writing on this afternoon's agenda items. So hope you have a great rest of the summer. I've just moved back from Holland to here. Now in the Netherlands, 70 degrees is considered hot. And I'm told that this is a cool day here. I hope it cools down a little bit by the time I come back in September. So thank you very much, everybody. And operator, this concludes the MSC meeting for today.
The call is now concluded, and you may disconnect.